You're listening to The Hollywood Saloon.
5 years ago, if I had to make a list of impossible things that could never happen, you performing a coup de grace on me by busting a cap in my crown would have been right at the top of the list. I'd have been wrong, wouldn't I?
This can't be happening, man. This isn't happening.
Focus on the memories.
Someday my dream will come. One night you'll wake up and you'll discover it never happened.
How the hell could this happen?
What happened?
Nothing ever happened in there.
What? What happened?
Never happened. Never happened.
Just focus on the memories.
You think it happened, and you're going to remember it like it might have happened, but it never happened, because we're telling you it never happened.
No matter how hard I wish, if I pray and wish really, really, really hard,
take it out. Erase it from your mind. Free your soul and your spirit, and you can think the way you want to think, because it never, never happened.
It erased.
Hey, what happened?
Never happened.
Hey! The basic idea of what we're talking about today here at the Hollywood Saloon, it's multiple facets of those two words, never happened. It's films that never happened. It's films that we never wanted to happen.
Isn't it kind of the story of Hollywood? Every single person that walked into that town had a film they wanted to make. Some of them happened. Most of them never happened.
Welcome to the Saloon. My name is Andy, and with me, of course, is John Jansen.
Welcome, welcome all.
And this time, we are going to look at things that never happened. They never occurred. Things that you have either dropped away from your mind, or things that came right up to the start line, and then for some reason or another, got abandoned. So we're not even really talking about movies this time, are we? We're talking about movies that never happened, so they don't really exist.
You mean this isn't a show about Cocoon the Return?
What? What was that? I have never heard of that movie before. I don't know what movie you speak of.
So we're talking about those type of films.
Well, that's one of the kind of films we're talking about. See, that's the situation here, is that there's multiple versions of Never Happened. And I think one of the ones that probably people understand the most and been talked about before in film circles, obviously, are those films that were in development, that got started, you heard rumors about, and then for some reason or another just got abandoned and they never took place.
Right now, there's 1,000 screenwriters who are living in L.A. who have all written a script, gotten an agent, sold a script, and it never got made.
Right.
It's sitting on a shelf somewhere, and it might never get made. There are writers out there who make a good living by never getting a credit. So you got a lot of projects out there in the limbo, but you also have the other kind of never happened. And I think this is really going to be the heart of this show. Many of those films are on that sort of epic list of never happened, of we never will get a chance to see them because they never even got to the starting gate, or maybe they got there or were canceled, or something happened to them in terms of a version of a film, or something, you know, was lost on it. There's different varying degrees of the way that you could sort of just take the words never happened. It really does open up a good long discussion for these lost films.
You know, there was always those dream projects that either they developed, they decided they were going to make, and then we never got to see. So it's kind of like that director's vision of this film that we always wanted to see, but they never got to. And maybe, you know, in the case of Kubrick, let's say he passed away, or another film came up. And it's fascinating to me that these things exist out there. They're in kind of film culture, and people talk about them. You know, we saw something like that, and this is a different kind of version of it, that did happen, was, say, like AI. When he passed away, and then obviously got passed on to Spielberg, and as an homage to Kubrick, he went and did that. So that was a did happen when it easily could have been a never happened,
right.
even though Kubrick obviously wanted Spielberg to direct it in the end. But, you know, you see that with different directors. You know a lot about this. Is Kubrick had a number of projects like this.
Actually, he did. I think one of the most famous is, of course, his Napoleon project. And this was the film that he was prepared to do directly after 2001 for MGM. And there's a lot of great, fascinating stories behind the creation of this film. There's been a couple of documentaries. One of them, Stanley Kubrick's Boxes, is quite revealing. But when you realize the amount of research that he did, as a filmmaker, he wanted to make the great Napoleon film. And one of the things he did is he built a card catalog based on every day of Napoleon's life. He read every single book ever written about Napoleon, and he also got some of the noted Napoleon experts on his speed dial on his telephone. And can you imagine Stanley Kubrick in 1968-69 can pretty much call up any CEO in the world, whether you work for Sony or Hitachi or you're a scientist or you're like Ed DeGaio, who worked on those lenses he later used for Barry Lyndon. You have these people, and they want to have a conversation with Stanley Kubrick when they hear he's on the other end of the phone. So he was able to gather research. Any question he had about Napoleon, no matter how minute it was, he had people and resources available to him. So he created a card catalog to where he could thumb through and go, well, what was he doing during the summer of... He could go and look up exactly, and he'd have all the months, and whatever information they had would be on a card. So he was sort of working on a very large scale. I also know that in order to sort of pull off the type of battle scenes he wanted to do, he needed the use of a small army. But he also needed to where they could march to the location, because just to try and transport 20,000 people, can you imagine how many trucks it'll take?
Wait a minute. Now, why would he do that when he could just do it on CGI? Come on.
Yeah, or just opticals and dissolves, right?
Yeah, not quite.
But not only did they have to get an army, how do you costume everybody? How do you afford to put every single person in an authentic costume of the time period? And they came up with this idea of paper costumes, to where the people in the way, way in the back would have this type of disposable costume, to where it could be just spray painted on. And based on the lenses and the way the film would be shot, it would be enough to cover it in the far-off distance. This is the type of degrees and the thought that went into the making of this project. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating is Taschen put out a 10-volume book last year about Kubrick's Napoleon. And it's just all his research volumes, thousands of photographs, the type of production designs for the costumes and all the research materials he was using. His screenplay was included. It was a limited edition of, I think, 1,000 copies. And if you can get one for under $2,500 today, I guess go grab it if you can afford something like that. Because it's going to be the next closest thing you have to sort of seeing Kubrick's Napoleon.
Right.
And I think by understanding the type of research he went into it, he thought he could do it in a 3-hour time period. He thought that would be an appropriate amount of time to try and canvas the man's life. And he found all kinds of very interesting small details. I always remember the opening scene of the screenplay, or one of the opening scenes, had Napoleon as a young boy in sort of a boys' school. And he sets a glass of water out on his windowsill, and in the morning it's frozen solid. And he doesn't understand why. He hadn't quite been educated into the concept of ice in that sense. And it's kind of interesting when you throw the bone in the air and you get to Napoleon's defeat in Russia. It had a lot to do with the hooves of the horses not being prepared for ice. So in small little ways, I think there's a lot of potential to create a great film out of a very fascinating figure. And I think, obviously, Kubrick's research and attention to detail certainly would not have disappointed.
Well, and you know what's exciting is the fact that these volumes do exist, these books exist. So in a way, we can say it never happened, but actually, we have the materials to almost recreate it in our minds. You can consider Kubrick's style. You can consider how he shoots things. And really, almost if you read the screenplay, you could create it in your mind. So I think that's a fascinating thing, that there's people, you know, look to him still after all these years enough to say, we want to have that available because it's important, even though this film never got made. So my big question is, what happened? Why did this stop? Why did this film not make it?
What was Kubrick's Waterloo? Well, it was a film called Waterloo, in fact. The Rod Steiger Napoleon film that came out and died a quick death at the box office.
Right.
And it scared off MGM from investing into a big, large, epic-type film.
Right.
And Kubrick at that time was committed to doing a certain type of film, and he did not want to budge from that. And at that time, you got to remember that the culture was shifting a little bit. Easy Rider had happened. Pretty soon, Five Easy Pieces is going to come out. You know, there's sort of a new, I guess you could call it the hippie cinema, grabbing a camera, cinema verite style, like right. The French and the European guys, and go out and make that small other little film. And Kubrick did go in that direction, and he made Clockwork Orange after reading the novel and shot it very, very small and for a smaller budget, but got that film out of his system. And I guess a lot of people think that Barry Lyndon was sort of the Napoleon replacement film, if
right,
you will.
Right.
Whereas a lot of that research that he had poured into Napoleon sort of carried over into Barry Lyndon eventually. But one of the fascinating things I remember about Kubrick was, I wanted to learn more about him, and I always thought reading his screenplays would fill me in with all of this fantastic extra detail and all these extra scenes, and these great camera shots would be explained, and it would all be in there. Like you could reverse engineer. It's completely not that when you read a Kubrick screenplay. Yeah. In fact, they're very simple in many ways. Just a simple explanation of the scene, the characters in it, and the dialogue. It was almost as those decisions hadn't even been made yet in some ways, as he was waiting for more material to come in and for scenes to be fully explored. The Napoleon screenplay is a good read. Of course, it doesn't go into a lot of detail, and he's not taking up 20 pages for a 20-minute battle scene. He's just doing it in a couple of sentences on the page. And that will be decided later, of course. A 130-page screenplay could be quite deceiving when you know certain sequences are going to go on for much longer. But at least we do have that. And right. That's the kind of great gift of some of the projects we will be talking about, is the screenplays are floating around out there. So it kind of gives us a chance, the closest thing that you can get. And this is always what I kind of liked, because you know, whether you're a director or not, you can have the same experience as a reader that the director would have had on this project when they read it anyway. Or a director, whenever they read a project, you're just sort of seeing what the movie's like on the paper. And it either comes alive for you or it doesn't. But if the writing's good, most of the times it will.
Now, obviously, this was going to hit Kubrick again later on. He would kind of go through a similar process when he was developing what was called the Aryan Papers. And
right. God, the big follow-up to Full Metal Jacket.
Right.
I mean, for those Kubrick heads, that was just that period after 87, that wait, you know. And then the 80s ended, and then we were into the 90s. And it's like, okay, it's been a while now. When's the next Kubrick film?
Right.
And I remember hearing about a new Kubrick project. I didn't know what it was at the time. 93-ish. From what I understand, Kubrick spent at least a couple of years developing this project about the Holocaust. And he had read just about every book on the subject that he could get his hands on. And what had happened is he had developed Aryan Papers to the point of he had casted some people, he had costumes, he had locations scouted, he had a script ready to go. Everything was set, and then Schindler's List came out. He was supposed to, I think, begin shooting around January of 1994. So it was 93 happened, because you got to remember, while he was prepping Aryan Papers all through 93, Spielberg got out Jurassic Park, ran off, shot Schindler's, quickly edited and had it out by that December. And Kubrick just kind of felt like, you know, one Holocaust film too many. And there was always that interesting sort of conversation where he always said, what was the greatest film made about the Holocaust? And whenever someone would get down and finally come up to Schindler's List, he'd say, oh, really? Isn't that about the saving of 150 lives?
Right.
Not about the death of 2 million Jews or something like that.
People, I think people think it's the definitive Holocaust film. but really it's about Oskar Schindler saving many of the Jews. And it really isn't. I mean, you see scenes of it, obviously.
You actually see the scenes of them almost. Remember, they get into the showers. And, I mean, it's a frightening scene, and I think it's as close as we all want to get. And I think that's what makes that film unique is Spielberg found a way into that subject matter through that story.
Right.
And Kubrick finally, I think, came to the conclusion after Schindler's List, it's like, you can't do it without showing it. And then it's like, how do you show it? How do you film it?
Right.
How do you do it? And I think even he was questioning, and his wife has gone into detail about this in several interviews about how she was kind of glad that he moved away from that and that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, the other way is that he could have gone like it was, if you remember, the Holocaust miniseries that was extremely graphic when they had, you know, nude people lined up and they were just, you know, lying, and then they'd shoot them and then you'd see all the bodies buried. And it was just like, you know, it's like, do we really even want to go that far in a film? I think you can obviously imply it like he did. And it's like, you know, do you go too far? Do you go to them? It's like nothing could ever grab the horror.
Now, I think that's a clear case where I'd love to read the screenplay.
Right.
Because then I could see what the tale was. Because it was about a young boy and his aunt traveling across the country just trying to survive. So I'm sure there was probably a very interesting... He found a story to at least, you know, again, enter into the Holocaust as a subject matter and trying to find the film in it or a film in it.
Well, you know, it makes me wonder if possibly... Instead of saying, I'm not going to make these films, maybe with Napoleon because of its size, but I could see maybe he just decided, well, maybe I'll get to Aryan Papers later, and let's let Schindler's List do what it's going to do, and we'll put it on the back burner. And then he just never got that opportunity because he passed away. So
he was a director that always had several projects in development. He had already been working on AI from as early as the mid-80s.
Right.
When he optioned the short story and brought in a lot of different writers to work on different ideas. He had had Eyes Wide Shut since at least the early 70s. He had already had that novel and been trying to tinker with that one. So that one took a long time for him to sort of gestate and think over. So there's even a few other, I've read about other Never Happens of screenplays that he wrote during some of his early days and, you know, other projects. And it's always kind of interesting because, I mean, every director we like, even Sam Peckinpah. I mean, I have a screenplay right now called Save the Tiger that he wrote, you know?
Right.
And it was probably just one of those he banged out while, you know, kicking back booze just to see if he can get a picture.
A picture?
You know?
Let's get a picture.
Let's get a picture made.
Let's do a picture.
And, you know, cranked out a script and then, you know, set aside and then went and worked on another one.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think there's always going to be... Hollywood is littered. There's all these little runts out there. But I find them fascinating because you never know what sort of wonders they might have grown into had they had a chance to see the light.
One of the ones that I've always considered and thought about that I would have loved to have seen was what Welles was doing back in his younger days when he was considering doing Hearts of Darkness. Because obviously, you know, we know what Apocalypse Now became and that Coppola, you know, sort of based that film on Hearts of Darkness in a modern way, you know.
And Welles would not have gone that route, probably.
Right.
You know, taking the war angle, especially the Vietnam War, which made that
of
so
course.
Perfect.
Yeah.
No, I guess he was trying to do an accurate adaptation of the story, and that's what stumped him
right.
when he first started at RKO. But, yeah, it is kind of a fascinating what-if because, you know, Welles also falls into that other never-happened category of you take a film like Magnificent Ambersons, and, you know, it's very famous for being, you know, the follow-up to Kane, and it had its last reel, or at least a good 20, 30 minutes, chopped out of it.
Right.
When Welles was out of the country in Rio de Janeiro shooting a film for the United States government, and the studio, for whatever particular reasons, shortened it up and destroyed all of those existing negatives and prints. So there was just no way that it could even be constructed back to, you know, his original vision that he had. And I remember a few years ago they remade Magnificent Ambersons for television, and they were really boasting based on the original script by Orson Welles, you know, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Good way to go. And yes, you'll probably get to now see some of those other scenes, but it's not really the same thing now, is it?
Yeah, it's not under the auspices of Orson Welles, so I think it's going to be a little different.
We did get a gift recently with Metropolis. Think about that.
Yes.
It was long thought lost, never happened. The longer version that was the original intentions, I guess, of the filmmaker.
Right.
When he was first putting that film together, it was obviously cut down for its American release. Now we have, I think, which is now the most fullest version of the film available. They found some 16mm scratchy print down in a basement somewhere, which I always find fascinating that, you know, these great lost treasures are just sitting in somebody's basement and they have no idea.
Right, been sitting there for years. Could have thrown it out and wouldn't have known what they had.
But now we have Metropolis, and now it's playing in theaters, and it's going to come out on DVD.
Right.
And I know there's a few of our listeners out there that can't wait, and they're as excited as I am. And, I mean, I was just happy that it played on German television. I was able to get a copy of it and watch it, and I didn't even care if it was in German. I could just still watch the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just such a brilliant piece of work. But, so, yeah, there's a Never Happened, that kind of a story that kind of came true. But there's, you know, sadly, most of these, it's not going to end so kindly. They're going to stay in the Never Happened and Never Will category.
Well, and it's interesting because we look back to those old classics and, we wish that we could have seen those. But there's plenty in our time now.
Oh, you mean like E.T. 2, Nocturnal Fears?
You wanted an E.T. sequel, didn't you, when you were a kid? Come on. It's like, this is the biggest movie of all time. Are you kidding me? We're not going to get a sequel to this thing?
Imagine this. What is it? Like June, whatever, 6th or 12th, E.T. comes out, okay? Does gangbuster business, not for the first week, only the first week, but the second week, the third week, and the fourth week. It keeps making more money every week, okay? It's a month later, July, let's say 12th or 14th. You're Steven Spielberg. You call Melissa Matheson over. All right, we got to work out a scenario for E.T. 2. I got an idea. It's called Nocturnal Fears. And this is what happens. And how come we know this? Because somewhere out there, they committed it to paper with dates on it and everything. And we get the treatment of E.T. 2 Nocturnal Fears. And when you read it, it's quite clear that what kind of state of mind they might have been in. But I think what is also quite clear is a month later, E.T. went from being just a big hit to one of the biggest hits of all time.
Right.
And they buried that sequel forever after that. And they were never going to even consider it.
We've read the treatment for E.T. 2, Nocturnal Fears. And let me just say, thank God that this didn't happen, because it was horrible.
Oh, you didn't like the fact that Keys and the mom were dating a year later?
Well, of course, makes sense, right? Yeah, it was. And I think we can make this available on our podcast page.
Yes, we'll have as many links to these screenplays as possible.
Right.
So come on over down to the Hollywood Saloon, hollywoodsaloon.com. Look up this podcast page and look for the gold, because it's out there.
Now, let me tell you something else about E.T. 2, is that E.T. 2, well, actually, E.T. came from another sequel idea, because at the time when Spielberg made Close Encounters, there was discussion of a Close Encounters sequel, okay? And this was called Night Skies. And what happened was that instead of the good aliens coming down this time, you had the bad aliens come down this time and terrorize a family. And what happens is you had kind of a good alien, and then the bad aliens would come. And there was this kind of interaction going on, with the good aliens were obviously the ones that we saw at the end of Close Encounters. But then there's another, you know, another breed of aliens that were the bad guys, and they. But when all this started rolling around and discussion became more, that got spun off into two separate films, and one of them becoming E.T., which is obviously the good aliens. But at the same time, what are we going to do with these bad aliens? That he's like, well, that's a good idea. Well, that could become Poltergeist.
Poltergeist, right.
Exactly.
Or E.T. 2 Nocturnal Fears.
Well, and see, and that's what it is it really all these like, never let an idea go to waste, right?
Spielberg. Talk about your recycle Hollywood, right?
That's for sure. But it, you know, and it worked perfectly, obviously, in this case, for both parties, is that you know, out of this Close Encounter sequel, we got E.T., which would become the biggest movie of all time. And then we've got Poltergeist, which was a really fantastic and popular film.
Well, what's terrible is Columbia didn't get a piece of either one of them. And they're the ones that wanted the sequel to Close Encounters in the first place. Right. Universal got E.T. after Columbia passed on it. They went with Starman. And MGM got Poltergeist, right? So,
well, and then, of course, with E.T. 2, remember there was a book written, what, called Green Planet or something like that?
Right. Now, that was the proper nice sequel where E.T. goes home and we get to see what it's like from E.T.'s perspective on his planet. E.T. 2 Nocturnal Fears is obviously, it's like the inverse of the first movie. Instead of a good alien coming down, it's bad aliens coming down.
Right.
And like Gremlins, there's a bunch of them. And they wreak havoc. And, you know, I mean, I just remember that the sequence of, like, Ellie gets captured and he's tortured and all the kids are put in danger.
Right.
I mean, real danger. Kids in danger being harmed. And it's interesting that that's where Spielberg's mind is 4 weeks after this movie has opened and done really well. I mean, I'm guessing it hasn't hit the stratosphere yet, because his thinking on it is obviously going to change, and his whole attitude about, you know, how he'll protect E.T. the way he did, you know, for so long. Remember, it wasn't on home video for at like ever,
right?
And then it had to finally come out, and then they just burned it out by playing it every Thanksgiving. So by the time they re-released it in 2002, nobody came.
Yeah. Oh man. But anyways, continuing on the Never Happened route. Now, the big Never Happened. The big Never Happened.
Do you think we'll ever get a sequel to E.T.?
Absolutely not. Not by Spielberg.
You mean these rumors about Drew Barrymore contacting Spielberg and saying, hey.
I think it would be a mistake. You know, I really don't think it's necessary. I mean, would people want to see it? Sure. But, I mean, they also wanted to see, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull as well, and we saw what happened there. It's like, kind of like, just, you know, you've gone this long. Just let it sit. You know, it's like, just make something else. There's plenty of other things you can make. So, yeah, let's hope for a Never Happened on that one, really.
Well, isn't it hard not to just do the same story again? I mean, like a typical sequel.
Of course.
It's going to have to be basically the same kind of beats, if you will. You know, he'll come back and they'll have to hide him and, you know, all this other stuff.
Yeah. It's like I've seen it once. I don't need to see it again.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Now,
it'll never happen, and it's a good thing.
It'll never happen, let's hope. All right. Now, the big one for us, and go back to the old days of Starlog, and there was this dream fantasy that was imparted, okay?
Wait a second. I'm smelling it.
Just.
It's coming.
It's coming.
It's like that sneaky right hook you're always throwing on me when I least expect it. But I do expect it. It's like some mysterious force that wants to warn me. We're about to talk about Star Wars, aren't we?
What, am I not going to say it? I mean, come on. Back in the days of Starlog, when Lucas gave the grand interview, where he talked about a great lava fight between Anakin Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi. Except he probably didn't even call him Anakin Skywalker at the time. It was just Darth Vader. And we had seen that in our mind and fantasized about it for so long. And now we have that. You know, that actually happened. And it's like, it was so exciting that we actually got that. But there was also discussion, and he'll probably deny it these days, is that there was going to be 9 films. 9 Star Wars films.
7, 8, and 9.
Exactly. That we were going to take care of the prequel and then come back and see Luke rebuilding the Jedi Order.
Didn't he always say they would be much older, though, in 7, 8, and 9? Because he would make the prequels next. And then by that time, Luke and Han and Leia would be older. Which is, because it's not really all about them. It would be about, you know, another.
Well, and maybe their kids or something like that.
Or other, you know. So, I mean, but I do remember reading that. And that's the great thing about the book, The Secret History of Star Wars, that, you know, it's kind of, I think, the new Bible, if you just want the history of the saga. All the interviews that Lucas has given, all the information that one time or another appeared out there has been collected into one massive volume. And there's just so much rich goodness to be found. I mean, I finally read about the version of Return of the Jedi that will never happen.
Right.
You want to talk about my big never happened. Forget 7, 8, 9 for just a second. My big never happened is the Return of the Jedi, or at the time, Revenge of the Jedi, that Lucas had planned and actually put to paper before he shifted his mind about what he wanted it to be specifically and went in the direction that eventually became. Well, I was really glad to finally read about it. To read about some of the subplots he had in mind with Darth Vader and his intentions and what he was trying to do with Luke and the Emperor. Really fascinating stuff that I think would have made a much deeper and richer film that would have sort of counterbalanced, I think, some of the other kiddie fare and hijinks that
right.
just that feel like overtake the tone of that film so often. I mean, we get our moments, to be sure, during the battle and, of course, you know, Vader's funeral and so forth. But I just think that the original film that Lucas had written out and had in mind was the film I wanted and never got. So at least reading about it in this form and just the snippets that I got was certainly worthwhile. And I tell you, I love the idea of 7, 8, and 9 as a Star Wars fan. Now more than ever, as an animated film, like a CGI, really good, classy 235 scope, but really do a great job on it, because then you could bring in all the voice actors.
Right.
And heck, you could even let Mark Hamill voice the villain. He'll love that, right? but you could really do it now in a good way, to where, you know, you could draw them however you want them to look, and the voices would be there. And I think after 2 minutes, we wouldn't even care. If the story's good, we'll just be into it.
Well, I think the technology certainly exists, and we know that Lucas likes to play in that world of making things almost photorealistic. You could almost make it photorealistic unless, you know, except with the exception of the people and their faces. So, and that's pretty damn close already anyway. So I think, yeah, that would be something to look at. Whether or not it's actually ever going to happen, I mean, we obviously have, you know.
Well, Star Wars is back in a big way right now. It doesn't need to happen because I think of the area that he is. He's got his current Clone Wars TV show and that other live-action Star Wars and Robot Chickens, and there's all kinds of Star Wars product out there. But do you remember those Timothy Zahn books that came out?
Right, that's what I was going to say, is that we actually have a version of what it might look like if that
right.
were to happen. Now, you know, whether or not we obviously called that expanded universe. Now, whether actually we want to take that and make that canon, of course, revert back to our previous show. And, you know, that's a choice.
Well, those books were actually responsible for reviving Star Wars
sure.
in many ways, because it had been dormant pretty much since Return of the Jedi. The toy line had sort of fallen off, and that's when the idea came to sort of, what do you think about expanding out with these books? Now, he had done it before in between, like, Star Wars and Empire. Remember those Han Solo books that came out? And there was a couple of others, but they never really went too hog wild. In terms of creating a whole universe, alternate universe,
right.
just for novels. But I think that's what was so surprising about the Timothy Zahn books. I think they shot up on the bestseller list, and they did very well. And it was the Star Wars sequel at that time that we could get because it had the main cast.
Right.
It was trying, I guess, to be like a 7, 8, 9 because it was a 3-volume series. There again, you got your trilogies.
Yeah, but you know what? Let's just say this. You don't think you would get a thrill out of seeing Harrison Ford as Han Solo again up in a spaceship, some sort of ship blasting away and flying again? That, seeing him today at his age, come on, that would be as exciting as hell. You know, but, you know, again, this is something I think that we've let go of. You know, Lucas said that was not the intention. So, I mean, in a way, while we do have it, like, you know, like having a script for something else, we still don't really have it, and so it never happened. And I think, you know, really, it's everyone's probably okay with that. But enough Star Wars. Come on. While we're talking sci-fi, another big one that I think we always wanted to see continue, and it's not that the sequel was so great, but, you know, Snake Plissken was a great character for us, you know, and for the world. And, you know, there was that talk, just a little bit of talk, that Carpenter was going to go for a third and go Escape from Earth.
Right. I always heard it was called Escape from Earth.
Right.
I don't, to me, I don't know if that was necessarily the direction to go, because I don't know what you do. Is it Snake in a spacesuit out in space? Is he in a spaceship flying somewhere? Is he on another planet? I don't know. It's just too much of a mess. To me, it should have been Escape from the USA. All right? Escape from fucking America. See if you can just get out of the country into whatever else the part of the world looks like.
Either that or, and I'm thinking, you know, he just gets put on ice for a few hundred years, right? He gets put on ice because that's how they... He gets caught for doing some other crime.
Well, if it can work for Jason X...
Okay. I never saw Jason X, so excuse me if I'm walking over Jason's territory here. But, you know, I mean, why not? You wake him up a few hundred years later or something, then he's out there in space and wherever he is. That's how they put away their criminals, a la Minority Report. And then he gets to go and do his thing, right? And do that Snake Plissken mm-hmm. thing and save another president.
It would be great to get a real sequel. And by that, I mean not one that just wants to sort of redo the first movie again.
Exactly.
Like Escape from L.A. does.
Exactly.
And, I mean, yes, didn't we cover that in Guilty Pleasures?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Because that's kind of where that movie can kind of fall into.
Well, and I think really it's just a desire to have Kurt Russell and John Carpenter get back together again and do it one more time instead of this bullshit talk of remake that they've been talking about for the last couple years. It's like that's the last thing.
Well, it would be interesting if it was like Escape from America, or you use sort of you got to get from one end of the coast to the other. So it would be like, instead of traveling through different districts of, you know, New York, you got to get through different states of this country. And they're all battle zones, like the Road Warrior, in one way or another. So I think you could make an interesting movie out of that kind of concept and still have all the requirements you need for a snake on a mission type thing.
Right.
But, you know, no, we don't do that these days. We reboot. We tell the same story
again
for the third time. The third time we're going to see the same story.
See, even though Kurt Russell said he was more than happy to play the character again, the point is that they wouldn't be satisfied with the kind of money they made before, because everything now has to be a blockbuster, has to be shot for $150 to $200 million. They're not going to greenlight it at $40 million. They're not going to give them chump change. No, it's got to be a massive across-the-table hit. And so it can't just service the science fiction fans. I think that's what hurts the most, is that science fiction fans don't get food anymore because they can only get, you know, a massive bonanza of a buffet table that never ends. They have to be so big. We can't just get sweet little science fiction movies like we used to get, like Escape from New York and They Live and those little gems that John Carpenter dropped along the way. I would love to see sci-fi return to that. But, so Escape from Earth never happened, but I don't know. I just wish that we'd get another chance to see Kurt as Snake. Now, another one, remember at the end of Buckaroo Banzai, and Buckaroo Banzai is that crazy, silly Peter Weller thing that was just so much fun, but also had a nifty science fiction bend to it. But, you know, I think it was even in the credits, wasn't it? They were talking Buckaroo Banzai against the World Crime League.
World Crime League, that's right.
And we were expecting, it's like, well, if they remember that, that's another kind of never
happened. That deserves its own category, because that's my favorite category.
Yeah.
Is movies that have the balls to say, guess what? Here's our next installment, and here's the title. Yeah. Now, a lot of them I know drop it as a joke. Mel Brooks famously did it in History of the World, Part 1.
Right, and everyone thought that Jews in Space and Hitler on Ice was really going to happen.
I know. For years, he'd get asked, hey, when's Part 2 coming out? It's like, I did Part 2. It was the trailer you saw.
It was the trailer, you idiot.
I do remember that about Buckaroo Banzai. Of course, that never happened.
Never happened.
But one of my favorites is Making the Grade. The Judd Nelson movie.
Yep.
They actually had a tag at the end that those guys were going to return.
Back then, I guess you just decided ahead of time, well, we're just going to do it. And I remember they did it with Doc Savage way back when the Ron Ely Doc Savage came out. It was so corny, but they're like, this is such a hit franchise. I mean, this was pre-Indiana Jones, but so much in the Indiana Jones kind of vein.
Don't you think it comes from Bond? I mean, they were doing that in the Connery era and most of the Moore era.
Absolutely.
At least half of it. Of at least announcing what the next film was going to be. So, I mean, and that was sort of the, I guess, the granddaddy of that kind of series.
Sure.
So, yeah, I could see where you would want to nod or even turn it into a gag in that kind of sense.
Well, James Bond will return in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. How many times was that on? Three movies or something? You remember for years, there was this discussion that Arnold was going to be attached to I Am Legend.
I remember that, with Ridley Scott, right?
With Ridley Scott directing, and it was like, wow.
Or Paul Verhoeven, was that it? One of those guys?
I think it was, no, it was Ridley.
Oh, Crusades, that was Verhoeven, right? That's the other never happened.
That's the other never happened with Arnold. Okay. Was it, remember, there was a few projects that Arnold was attached to that were just perfect for him. It's like, when you hear what I Am Legend is, considering the kind of movies he was making at the time, you know, it was always Arnold versus this, Arnold versus that, Arnold versus Satan. It's like, well, what about Arnold versus the world, you know, the dead of the world, and he's the last man on earth? Well, that makes complete sense. And, but, you know, it just stayed in that development hell. And, of course, you know, eventually it did happen, but obviously without Arnold. But I think I would have probably...
Well, they had to wait for digital effects to catch up, right?
Yeah. God, that's... And sadly, isn't that what people remember the most about that movie? Is the corny-looking... zombies or whatever they
creatures,
were.
I know.
It's just like...
I mean, it completely overtakes all the excellent CGI work that they did on the city and so forth.
Right.
But when I see fake deer and fake zombies, it's like yawn.
Yeah, it takes me exactly. Right out. Takes you right out. And that hurts that. And I guarantee you that at the time when they were discussing this project with Arnold, there wouldn't have been that technology. And they certainly couldn't have done it back when they did Charlton Heston with the Omega Man, which is the same story as I Am Legend.
Same story, right.
Right. So, and which I think is superior to the Will Smith version, in my opinion. That was an Arnold version. And again, the Verhoeven with Arnold was so discussed for so long. And eventually we'd get Ridley Scott's take on that. And I don't know if that killed anything about it, but it was certainly years that Arnold was like, this is my next project. We're going to do the Crusades. And, of course, right. that never came to fruition either. Now, a couple more in the sci-fi area that I want to talk about real quick. Remember before the Burton remake of Planet of the Apes, there was discussion of Oliver Stone's Planet of the Apes.
And James Cameron's. Because wasn't Schwarzenegger attached to that one, too?
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah, I think I remember something about that. So,
yeah. But, yeah, I remember the Stone. Stone got close.
Well, they knew that it was... This was an untapped property that had been so popular throughout the late 60s and the 70s. And how can we get back to this? You know what I mean? Was the discussion. And obviously, I think at this point, you're talking to reboot whoever did it. And I know that something with stones had to do with there was something in the Bible code about apes rising or something. And it started from there. And it was just like, what in the world? But there wasn't much more about that. But I think that there was serious discussion that he might go that way. Now, I would have happily seen a James Cameron version or an Oliver Stone version. I think it would have been easy to go. It's one of my favorite film series ever.
And you can't really blame him, too, when Battle ended in, 74, 75, and the TV show was already done. After the TV show, there was no more Planet of the Apes.
Right.
That I mean, really, Star Wars... took its place and just almost buried it in the sense that they never even tried resurrecting it in any kind of form until we finally did get the Tim Burton remake, reboot, whatever it was,
right,
in 2001. And now here we're in 2010, but in 2011 we're going to get Caesar, Rise of the Apes. So
right.
We're, again, getting back to the apes, but now we're going to get CGI apes. But you know what? The guys at Weta are doing it, and I can't wait to see their work. It's hard to bash artists before you give them a shot to show you what they can do, and I know they're going to wow us all. And it's just a different kind of vibe, so I can't wait to see what they do.
You know what? I certainly think that Rick Baker did an amazing job on Burton's Planet of the Apes. That's a film that's grown on me after time. I didn't really like it very much, but it's slowly grown on me over the years.
You can turn off the sound of that movie, and it's extremely watchable.
Sure.
Just in terms of stuff to look at, and you're right, the ape costumes and makeup are extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the actors are really good, too, behind them, Roth especially. So, yes, I agree with you. There's all kinds of interesting things going on. For me, the movie doesn't work, though. the sum of its parts fall apart, and it fails to be a pleasing and energetic and exciting and satisfactory film experience. Although, yeah, there's a lot of good things I can take away from it.
Well,
absolutely.
And that's like I said, it's grown on me over the years because I've just let it be what it is and not try to inject, okay, this should be so much bigger. It has a small feel to it. If you go back to Planet of the Apes and you think about the expanse you felt and how huge the Forbidden Zone felt. And how daunting, you know, and it felt like it just consumed the whole world. Whereas to me, the Burton film felt like it was like one little village. You know, it was like, was this really the whole Earth or is this just one little village? It really felt big in the original.
Tell you what, that opening shot of Conquest, it feels like there's a lot of apes. They're just coming out from every direction.
Well, the deal is that the older series felt it had an epic scope to it, I think. And really, that's one of the things that hurts this Burton film is it just feels really small. Now, moving on, today we know what happened with Neil Blomkamp and Peter Jackson, how they were developing a film for Halo, the video game, the Xbox video game, and that they were ready to go on that. Jackson producing brought on Neil Blomkamp and said, "This is my guy. I trust him, and let's make this movie." But as the budget grew, and we knew that with a film like this, the scope of the video game is just massive. I mean, it's just, you know that in special effects costs and such, you're going to have a budget that just explodes. As this budget was exploding, the studios were saying, wait a minute, you're going to use a first-time filmmaker on this? Someone who's never made a feature-length film before, or at least one of any budget? And after that, they said, well, you know, we can't do it. But Jackson wasn't ready to jump into that because he thought that Blomkamp was perfect for it. So they put faded away and never happened. And it may still happen because Halo has got a massive appeal to it. And video game movies now, you're going to be seeing a lot of them.
But isn't that film going to happen anyway? I mean,
well, I think it will eventually. I'm sad that Neil Blomkamp didn't get to do it. At the time, nobody really knew. But now we know. See,
you're not sad. You got District 9.
No. I like the Halo story. If Halo would have been made, I wouldn't have known the difference, right? So in a way, sure, now that I've seen District 9 and I love District 9, but I certainly would like to see his Halo movie. You know, and he did some shorts, some promotionals for Halo 3, and you can see those on Xbox Live and on YouTube and whatnot. I'll put some links on there on the Saloon TV.
That doesn't sound like never happened to me. That sounds like gonna happen. So
yeah, but
I don't
maybe
know.
Not from his hands is what I'm telling you. If McGee gets it, you're not going to get the same thing. So it would never have happened.
Yeah, Peter Jackson presents a film by McGee.
Well, Peter Jackson is not involved anymore. It's left his hands. So we don't know who's going to end up with it or if anyone does it at all. Video game movies are hugely difficult to produce because there's no, you know, when they make the video game, there's nothing hindering your vision. You know?
At the cost, it would have to be the highest grossing video game movie ever. It would have to do triple of what the last highest grossing
And the point is that video game movies don't make money. There's not been very many successful video game films. It's like, what, Tomb Raider's the biggest one of all time? Oh, no, or is it Prince of Persia? Yeah, thanks
or
a lot.
Hitman didn't bring them in?
Yeah, no. So, you know, and Doom didn't do very good.
What about Max Payne? How about that?
Yeah, that was great.
With all its slow-mo.
Yeah, terrible.
Okay.
So that's not, yeah. And, it's very risky. And we saw the same thing happen with Bioshock. That's another huge Xbox game that got shivved after a while. Gore Verbinski was all tied up to do that. And then budgetary reasons made him shut it down and reevaluate. And then he jumped ship. So that's still set to happen, but you know, it's not going to be under his vision. And it's funny now, because I think those same people, if they went to him after having seen District 9 and him proving himself, they probably would have said, yes, go ahead. We can see where you're at now. That's obviously not going to happen. That's been taken off the table for years and years and years. And this is one of the ones that was most important to me is that, and you know, David Fincher has so many movies that were supposedly going to be directed by him or him involved, and so many announcements that we've heard that he and Morgan Freeman were going to work on Rendezvous with Rama. And if you know anything about this, it's an Arthur C. Clarke story about a massive spaceship that enters orbit around Earth and, you know, that sends up a crew to investigate it. And it's just absolutely one of my most favorite stories of all time. And but there was talk about it for years. And I think always the talk behind it was, well, let's wait for the technology so we can really, really do it right. But it's been in discussion for many years, and I really think it's time that we get to some of these Arthur C. Clarke books that are so brilliant. You know, he's finally passed away now, but, you know, we've only had a chance to see two of his films ever made, and they're so absolutely brilliant.
From what I understand, the problem with Rama, besides the technology, certainly to do with, which you could probably argue the technology is there, but it's how much do you want to spend to get it to the level that Fincher wanted it. And that was always the problem, is the budget was getting too big for an esoteric sci-fi project like this. The second thing that it faced is finding your way around a story that everybody's been nicking from for years and years and years.
Right.
And that's the unfortunate side of Arthur C. Clarke, is because all those projects didn't get made in the movies, people have been borrowing a lot of ideas from all those novels for years and using them in other movies, to where if you did an accurate adaptation, you'd probably go, geez, I've kind of seen it.
Well, that's absolutely true. And even a few years ago, this director had been in discussions to do Childhood's End, which is actually the first Arthur C. Clarke book that I had ever read. And it blew my mind, you know. And one of the very first things that happens in the stories is that miles and miles wide spaceships come and park themselves over every major city in the world. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah.
Of course, this was written in the 50s, right?
There's still ways to do it that makes it visually different than Independence Day. There's a way to shoot that, and you don't have to use the same landmarks, and there's a way to do it in a different kind of way. But you're still already opening your movie with a similar presence and setup.
It's happened in Independence Day. It happened in V, that's on television right now. That's how that series opened. So, I don't know. It's interesting that was being discussed for a while.
Well, the other Arthur C. Clarke I thought was interesting is Tom Hanks's company had option 3001, The Final Odyssey.
Right.
I read about that years ago, and there's been absolutely zero traction on that project. And maybe it followed underway and never happened. Maybe they won't make it.
Well, I certainly wish that they would go back and touch on this 2001 series and end it out. You know, I mean, obviously, it left on a really great note in 2010 with All These Worlds, you know, Are Yours to Do With, and such. But, you know, there's more to the story. There was obviously two more.
Well, there's a great opportunity to sort of do a brother-sister scene to the shuttle docking in 2001 with the space elevators.
Oh.
In 3001, the whole idea of seeing that and all their position around Earth and watching a space elevator in action. And, you know, you could design the shot where it could just be one take that starts at the ground and just keeps going up, and you just see the whole thing and experience it. It could be an amazing shot and sequence in a movie. And as far as I remember, there's some interesting elements because they find, Poole frozen, floating out in space.
Right. Well, Frank Poole is the main character in the film. After 1,000 years of being frozen in space, technology has caught up with him to where they're able to revive him. And then he is the main character of the story. So, yeah, I mean, there's so much goodness there. The problem is, though, is that we're in such a day in science fiction right now where you can't have a movie like Contact come out where that's about the science, you know? It has to be all this war and battle and action. Science fiction is so tied up in action right now that no real science fiction stories can come out. There has to be a battle or a war or all this kind of stuff.
Wouldn't you argue, though, it's been tied up for about 35 years or so since Star Wars?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's been some movies that have snuck in.
Yeah, it's rare. There's a few, though. There's like, well, you can count them on one hand, that poked their head out and got out from under that wing. But it's tough. It's a tough sell.
It is. And sadly, those are my favorite kind. But anyways, let's jump over a little bit here. And I've got a little section here about fantasy. There's not too much. I can tell you that one of the things that I always loved about Conan the Barbarian was that scene at the very end where we saw Conan, King Conan, sitting on his throne.
And the fact that John Milius talks about three films on that commentary track.
Yep.
It's really too bad that, well, It's always been too bad that Conan the Destroyer happened the way that it did.
It really is.
And the fact that it came out at, what, PG-13 never happened in my book.
Yeah. It's definitely one of my never happened. It's just so horrible. And in no way, even remotely in the same genre of goodness as Conan the Barbarian. And it just didn't have that gravitas that Milius is all about. It didn't have anything to it, and it was just the whole the team and let's get Wilt Chamberlain. Are you kidding me? And just a bad thing altogether. It's too bad that Arnold was tied into that, and that remember it put off the filming of Terminator for like a year.
Mm-hmm. But it gave us what, Rambo 2 and Aliens.
Yeah. So, it's sad that we never got to see that. Now, obviously, if you're in the know a little bit, there is another Conan film being made right now.
Let me guess. Reboot. Remake. Ripoff.
What are you going to do? You going to ask Arnold to come and be on it? No. We're going to reboot the whole thing with someone we've never heard of before. And I've seen some of the stills. And, you know, it's like Kull the Conqueror. I mean, Xena, Princess Warrior. I mean, is it going to be like that? Is it going to be like Beastmaster? I mean, is it just going to be another layer of shit on it and a cheesed out one today? I don't know. I mean, who knew that Conan the Barbarian with Arnold was going to become what it was, or even if people still consider it that way? I think the only reason there's a film today has nothing to do with the source material. It has to do with the fact that people still consider that film a pseudo-classic. It's just a shame that we never got that. It's really sad that there's a lot of kind of projects that Arnold was involved with that we always hoped we would see and we never got to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially for you, Arnold boy.
Exactly. Now, moving forward, you could almost say that this kind of happened, but there was discussion for a while about a Gladiator 2. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. Nick Cave, right?
Yeah, it was kind of awkward because it was this whole story of possibly... And Ridley was going to be involved. This whole story of, Gladiator was going to be a warrior through the ages, and we would see him in different wars through time. You know, I mean, maybe you could even consider that kind of a Highlander thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Really what it was that I think that Ridley and Russell Crowe wanted to do, another one. They wanted to work together. They wanted to do another big epic war movie. And so, they kind of did that, right, in Robin Hood?
Mm-hmm. They found a way to do Gladiator 2 in Robin Hood, for sure.
Right, so they're kind of...
But yeah, no, a direct sequel with him returning as Maximus and all that, I think we can file that under Never Happened and
right.
Never Will.
Never Happened, Never Will. They've obviously, scratched that itch with Robin
Hood. I'm surprised they don't want to go prequel, but do you really want to see that?
There was nothing that had happened until then. He was a great champion for Rome. So, really, it didn't matter. Interesting lately, as Terry Gilliam has discussed going back to Who Killed Don Quixote, his Man from La Mancha project. And, of course, we know what happened with the original film in that it got, it was just plagued with production problems. Your main actor, he was sick and they had to replace him. He was injured.
He got a hernia, so he couldn't even sit on a horse.
Right. So, it really, it just all fell apart. And, if you've not seen Lost in La Mancha, which is a documentary that goes through the production nightmares that Gilliam had to go through, it's absolutely brilliant to see what happened. But that's a great never happened that we would love to see, especially after seeing the film, the documentary. But there's been whispers, right, that he's considering going back to that material.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And there's talk of Robert Duvall now taking over the role of Don Quixote.
Wow.
Or whatever the character they have envisioned for it. But we'll see. I mean, it's one of those that, Gilliam doesn't want to talk about it until he's got it in the can.
He's probably pretty jaded at this point, because we know it's just like trouble follows that man on his film sets. And it's a damn shame.
Yeah, sadly, the version that he set out to make, we'll never get that version for sure.
Exactly.
But, it'll be interesting if he does finally get to make the movie. That I'm sure what he comes up with will be worth watching.
All right. Now, we know that Guillermo del Toro had his fill. He said, I can't wait any longer. I've spent 2 years of my time developing The Hobbit, and that's it. I'm done. Because MGM is having trouble with their financing. So, you will not see the Guillermo del Toro version of The Hobbit. You will probably see elements of him working on that. You will see some design that he probably helped work on, script changes that he probably was involved with. So I think there'll always be an element of his hand in what you're going to see. But I think a thousand and a half fanboys raised a cheer when they heard that he was off the project, and they started praying and hoping that Peter Jackson might come and take the mantle and finish off his Lord of the Rings films. So you will not see that version, but we move forward, and now the latest is that Peter Jackson hopefully will take it. I don't think it's 100% confirmed at this point, but I think we're getting close to that point. And obviously there's stuff involved with the business side of it and MGM and whatnot. But that is a never happened. Now, there's another area we can dive into here, but one that I've always thought about is, and we've talked about this to a certain extent on other shows, but we still always hoped that we could have seen that James Cameron Spider-Man.
Right. Yeah, we have his script meant for sure, so we could kind of read it and imagine it. And yes, you do get your organic web shooters in there, for sure.
Well, and then as we've talked about before, that's responsible. He's responsible for that idea, and it was such a good idea. I'm glad that they took it. That was something that was in discussion for years. Now, if you remember, there was also discussion, though, when Canon had the rights to Spider-Man. And I remember sitting in the college library looking through varieties, because I'd always go through the varieties, or those annual magazines. It would just be full of film announcements, and it'd say, Canon presents Spider-Man. There'd be a picture of Spider-Man with the big Canon logo on there. I mean, what would that film have been like?
God, it would have been just like that Captain America film they barely released, you know, or that Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie that got buried. I can't imagine it being much more than that.
Yeah.
You know? Well, Canon was buying up cheap properties. You got to remember, when Canon was buying all this Superman and Spider-Man, nobody wanted them.
Right.
That's how out superheroes were in that type of even fantasy characters. They were not considered big screen commodities at all, which is so strange because of what Superman did. Now, this is pre-Batman, so Batman would again change the perception of all that again for a little while. And you know, that's what it takes. It's like every now and then it just takes that big film to remind everybody, oh, yeah, there's a lot of money to be made.
And then everyone started grabbing up all the superheroes that they could. And now look where we are today in overload mode.
When you even look at something like The Phantom when it came out, what, in summer 94?
Yeah.
That was developed out of Batman. It just took 4 or 5 years to get to the screen.
You know? Right. Yeah, but, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, continuing on Spider-Man. Now, one thing we have to consider at this point.
Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 4.
Exactly. If he would have continued on from where he left, what would have happened? Right. We obviously know that the door got slammed and they said, that's enough, and they parted ways.
We read a synopsis of what the story was about, dealing with the Vulture. In Peter's relationship with this new girl that happens to be the Vulture's daughter, and all of that. So we knew it was going into some familiar emotional territories and sort of the relationship between Peter and the villain again.
Right.
That we'd seen in some of the other movies. But, yeah, we'll never know. You know, was it the redemption ticket movie from Spider-Man 3 that Raimi got to finally make? And maybe, you know, make a companion piece of Spider-Man 2 or not. You know, we don't know. Never happened.
Right.
Never will.
Never happened. Never will. Was Spider-Man 3 really a Batman and Robin type film that predicated that we needed to reboot? I don't know. We'll see in a couple of years when this new Spider-Man comes out.
Well, according to the cost of making Spider-Man movies, they certainly thought so. Because from what I hear, they're paying the new Spider-Man. They got themselves a bargain.
Well, why do you want to pay Tobey Maguire millions when you can pay someone who's... It's like, you go up to any actor working day, hey, you want to be Spider-Man? Yes. Well, what would you like to make? He's like, I don't know. He's like, would you do it for scale? Sure. You know, who wouldn't? The world will open to this actor, and we'll see where that goes. Man. Now let's jump ship from Marvel over to DC. So many ways that you could split, twist, and turn around what they've been wanting to do with Superman for so long. Before Superman Returns came out, there was so much development there with J.J. Abrams.
With Tim Burton and Kevin
with
Smith.
Kevin Smith.
There's a bunch that never happens.
There's so many never happens.
Think about Superman.
Yeah, on their way to building towards what eventually would be Superman Returns. Nicolas Cage as Superman. J.J. Abrams' super reboot that would have changed many, many things.
From what I understand, there was a period where Alan Horde went to the board at Warner Brothers and they offered two different routes. They had the screenplay for Batman versus Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And it was written by Andrew Kevin Walker of Seven fame, and Wolfgang Peterson wanted to direct it. And that was one direction they could go. This is before Batman Begins also.
Right.
Or they could reboot Superman and get three films out of that in that kind of route. And that was the route they chose to go. They decided not to do the Versus movie, which I guess always comes with the stint of the last breath of a franchise.
Right, right.
In that kind of sense.
Not the beginning.
You know,
yeah.
Not the new breath, but the last breath. So they went the Superman route. And again, that's where you got all the Ratner and the McGee's and everybody else and JJ and all that development, you know, came. And then finally the Singer and... finally, Superman Returns, and now Batman versus Superman, or Superman versus Batman, whatever it's called, is still in limbo. I mean, the screenplay's out there, you can read it, and they still talk about making that movie, but I don't know if it's going to happen now. And now that Christopher Nolan is sort of guiding the DC-verse, I don't know if he's really interested in doing that type of movie. I don't think he's going to mix Superman and Batman, even though he is going to be producing both series, but I guess it's just a wait and see. Someday, they're going to make a live-action version of Superman and Batman. They're going to appear on screen together one day. So I won't say that'll never happen, but probably this project probably won't happen.
It's not going to happen in the foreseeable future because they're still trying to find a way. They obviously know they have life still in the Batman franchise, which will be at least one more film, we know for sure. And then
from
of course,
Nolan, we're going to get one more film.
Right. And then
there's going to have to be more films after that.
Oh, there of course will be. Now, whether or not it stays on the Nolan trajectory or not is what they'll have to investigate. Now, they're going to have to see also what happens with Nolan's produced Superman and see which way that goes, if that does indeed happen. But obviously, yeah, that was something that was very exciting. But at the same time, we all wondered, wow, that's pretty daring to go that route. Now, you remember there was another route they talked about for a long time with this Justice League movie.
That George Miller was going to do.
Right, and there was all this team-up discussion and all the characters. And they remembered that it was going to be different. They were not going to bring in the people from...
they were going to go young, and they were casting all these fresh faces, and it did not look very appealing in the early development stages. That's one of the never happens that I think I was kind of glad didn't happen.
Yeah.
Because it sounded like it was running into a train wreck. And that's going to be one of the more trickier things to balance is all those type of characters. You know, I know we talked about how the Avengers has its work cut out for them, and, you know, maybe it is a good idea for right now. We haven't really exploited the DC-verse that much on the big screen.
Right.
We don't have to rush into that necessarily at this time. It's there, and it'll happen someday, but I don't think we need to, you know, be making a flash to make it happen.
Well, and you know that when Superman Returns came out, that they had no intention of it being a standalone film. They were rebooting the series.
We should have had the second one by now.
Right. If they would have stayed on the trajectory... we would have had a second Bryan Singer Superman film. And I guess they were tentatively calling it The Man of Steel. And there you go. I mean, it did not happen. At this point, it won't happen. I don't think, not with Bryan Singer and Brandon Routh. Now, obviously, this is where they brought in Christopher Nolan to produce, and we'll see what happens. There's no way in hell with what happened with Superman Returns that they're going to make another sequel to that movie. I think that's dead. You're going to see probably some new type of reboot thing. Probably similar, it wouldn't surprise me, to something like they did with The Incredible Hulk and Hulk. A reboot, but a more serious... I wouldn't even know. I have no idea what Nolan's going to do with this thing, honestly, or where his sensibilities take it, other than something more dramatic and would feel more like it was in the real world. I'm fascinated, and I can't wait to see what happens with that.
Well, I'll tell you what is also interesting is something surfaced recently was the screenplay for the original Superman 3 that they were developing, or Superman 5, if you look at it that way. Both times they were trying to introduce, I think, Brainiac into the series.
Right.
And there was a more serious version of Superman 3 being considered by one of the Salkins, I think, at the time, but it got jettisoned in favor of course, the jokey Leslie Newman and so forth version. But it was a Superman 5 sort of designed for a Christopher Reeve to actually come back and try and do a real Superman movie again. And, it sounded like it had a very interesting concept, and it was fully developed. But I think it was sort of deemed as too expensive for its time.
Right.
And the special effects weren't quite advanced enough in 91 to really do a film like this, and 92. So it kind of got put by the wayside, and then, of course, just was never picked up again. But just, again, another one of those lonesome projects that are almost a dime a dozen in Hollywood. That's the sad thing. But, again, you know, we have the screenplays, and, you know, we can sort of imagine for ourselves what some of these films would be.
Now, imagine this is... And this is all bouncing off Superman as well, is that part of the reason that X-Men The Last Stand happened like it did was because Singer jumped ship to go do Superman Returns. And what we got was
the Brett Ratner thing. His part three has never happened. We'll never see that.
Exactly. The X-Men 3 that never happened because he left. And, of course, we got the Ratner garbage that we did. Was partly because of that. So that in that way, it's affecting another franchise.
Isn't that how funny how Ratner claims ownership over that movie? He didn't write it. It's not Ratner's film. He didn't come up with anything. He just was hired to direct traffic.
Director
but he gets the responsibility, you know?
Yep.
He gets all the credit for it. A Brett Ratner film. Well, you own it, buddy. It's all yours.
Hey, it made the money, though. Right? Made more money than any of them. So there you go.
Oh, he couldn't believe he outgrossed his heroes.
Yeah, he outgrossed Spielberg. Forget about, you know, any kind of... fixing it for inflation. No, that doesn't matter. What matters is he made more dollars than his year. I remember that statement. Oh, it was like...
That, no matter that it was a franchise that had two hit films, that people were just waiting for the third installment. God,
right.
Nimrod Attell could have directed that film. It would have opened up the same.
Pee Wee Herman could have directed that film and it would have opened the same, you know? Directed by Paul Rubens. What?
Wouldn't have mattered.
Who cares?
It could have been Richard Benjamin, you know?
Yeah. So, well, remember, there was also Matthew Vaughn was going to do X3 for a while.
That's true. All right. Now he's doing X-Men First Class.
Right. Isn't that interesting? So he jumps ship with X3, then he does Kick-Ass, and then they say, oh, Kick-Ass was kind of Kick-Ass. We like that. Want to come do part three? Part four, whatever the hell it is? Part four? Part five?
He must... Really, I can't wait to see his X-Men movie because this guy really wants it. You know,
yeah.
He walked away from the lion traps, and then now he's walking right back in. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, let's see. You know, 6 months from now, we say Matthew Vaughn off X-Men First Class.
Bryan Singer on?
No.
Or he's got too many projects now, right?
No, it's McGee on is what it's going to be because he needs work.
I guess Terminator films are now in the never happened category too, right?
Yeah. Any future Terminator movies never will happen.
God. Thanks, McGee. And just like everybody else, he gets the blame for that film too, even though he didn't write it.
Right. Hey, well, you know what? You and I can pull together $100 and probably buy the rights for Terminator at this point. Because everyone knows that, you know, what can you do at this point? Well, we've said before what's going to happen with that. We know. Reboot. That's what's going to happen with Terminator. Oh, we can't figure a way to make this happen. Just reboot the shit.
Can we call it now this time Terminators?
Yeah. Oh, didn't they already do that? Wasn't that one of those knockoffs?
How about Robert Rodriguez presents Terminators?
Fuck you, asshole.
Well, Well, this way the Terminator can, like, carry around a guitar case and it'll have a rocket launcher in it.
The world's first guitar-playing Terminator with a rocket launcher. Yeah, never happened, and even in our dreams, let's hope.
You're a terminated fucker.
So anyways, they're dealing with some heroes. Well, okay, Shyamalan is now, because he's probably in such trouble, started to say, hey, you know, remember that Unbreakable? Yeah, maybe we'll do a sequel to that. And that's something that everyone talked about for so long and never happened. He wanted to move ahead with different things, obviously. He's not kind of the one that seems like he would want to make more than one film. Interested? Yeah, because I like the first one so much. But really, I don't need to see it. It's all implied. We know where it's going. Really, that's kind of one of those things that's kind of mystical, and you need to just say, yeah, he went on and became this superhero in sort of a way, and is it necessary? Not really. But it's always there in case he wants to fall back on something, I'm sure.
It's again, you got to have a really dynamite story.
Yeah.
And otherwise, it's, you know, I mean, obviously, it can't be the same movie as the first movie because the dynamics are different. It's because of awareness, so.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Absolutely. Now, I want to look at some tunes, right? I just called it tunes, but, you know, for years there was discussion of a Roger Rabbit 2. And
still is, isn't there? I always hear about it, like, every other year or so. It's something comes up about it.
They still play around with that. Now, whether or not Zemeckis would be involved or not, I don't know. I don't know how much bigger they could go. Remember,
tell him he can do it in 3D.
Oh, yes.
Then he'll be all over it, right? Look, you can use your full motion capture system and 3D.
Yeah,
he'll
but
be like, I'm in.
Yeah, but he doesn't want real people in his movies anymore, so I don't know. I mean, I think, again, leave well enough alone. I think it's just one of those things that's retro. People think, wow, it'd be great to see that again because we had that before.
That's what makes it so special. It was a one-off. I mean, Mel Blanc was still alive to do the voice.
Right.
It took someone like Steven Spielberg to put Warner Brothers and Disney at the same table and shake hands and make an agreement to put Bugs and Mickey on screen
right.
at the same time. The piano duel is classic piece of movie making,
right.
cinema. I mean, come on, Daffy and Donald going at it?
Yeah.
It doesn't get any better than that. And so, yeah, I like that one as like a diamond in the rough. It's just a one-off that makes that movie so special. I've always liked the Roger Rabbit shorts that they've done.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a great way to exploit the character, and they could always continue in that kind of direction. Now, maybe there's another story out there that would change my mind, and they could make a dynamite movie out of it, but...
Well, it's interesting, you know, Disney still holds Roger Rabbit, you know, they still use him in their theme parks and such, and he's walking around at this point, probably. I'm wondering if most kids even know who he is, you know, because
right.
they'd be like, who's that rabbit? And they would only know.
I'm sure parents show them that movie, but there's just not the material.
Right.
No, nowadays, kids get so many episodes of whatever they like, cartoon-wise.
Right.
It's just very different.
Also in that, remember, for years there was discussion of a Jetsons movie. I think that, you know, obviously when the Flintstones films were made, that the obvious thing next was to move over to the Jetsons. They were just the mirror image of the Flintstones. And there was talk that Chevy Chase was going to be George Jetson.
That was the Joe Dante version, I think. I remember hearing about something like
yeah.
that. And then Robert Rodriguez was going to do it at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, and again, that's another one of those properties where... Would the kids even know who that is today? I mean, certainly it would have to be some sort of a nostalgia thing. But that's something that was even out before our time. It was, you know, all about reruns yeah. for us.
Here's a real retro idea for you. Take three of those kind of classic sitcom cartoons that you want to do live action and make a 90-minute movie, but it's just three vignettes. Film a live-action Jetsons, but only 30 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. And that's the Jetsons episode. And then you move into a 30-minute, I don't know, Johnny Quest. And then a 30-minute, you know, Flintstones to cap it off or something. I don't know. But you make it Variety Hour because then you don't have to stretch those properties out to 90 minutes where they just always feel like peanut butter spread
right.
out, you know, over 15 pieces of bread.
Could you imagine them trying to market that? That's something that would never, ever happen.
God, it works so perfect on the poster. You got, you know, three slides, you know, all three, one movie.
Never happened. Never, ever.
No. Oh, God, no. Are you kidding? That's the biggest never happen of all.
I mean, that would be too much. They would just say, that's too confusing. We want to be able to say the Jetsons
it's,
movie.
What? It's too Twilight Zone the movie for you?
Yeah.
It's too Creepshow? It's too any other New York stories right. or any other anthology movies that fail
exactly
every time they come
because
out?
Because people want to, they don't want short stories. They want a film, a whole movie, and that's...
They would rather have a bad 81-minute Jetsons movie than a really good 28-minute movie.
Well, look, I mean, we've had a Dennis the Menace movie. We had a Leave It to Beaver movie. I mean, you count it.
You just got Marmaduke.
Exactly. I mean, over and over and over again.
Why can't Marmaduke be never happen? Why can't that be the never happen?
Because cats and dogs dancing the fuck around and saying shit is fucking funny to people right now. I don't get it.
So we went from old people rapping to cats and dogs dancing and saying funny shit.
Blame it on Beverly Hills Chihuahua, I guess.
God,
I don't know.
That's comedy progress right there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I even saw the trailer for Marmaduke, and they're dancing and saying shit. Look at that crap now that's on the screen, that's on the TV ads and such for the kitty galore, you know, cats and dogs, and they're spying. I saw a little tabby cat take out a little spy camera and take a picture or something. Come on. What is he spying on? What do we need a cat to spy on? Oh, please.
I want to see a cats and dogs version of Spies Like Us. How about a kid's version of Spies Like Us?
Oh, man.
We got to do something with that property, quick.
Man, I could do a whole show that would just be a 100% rant on no more fucking spies. Oh, my God. Cats and dogs as spies. Brilliant. Well, shit, we had gophers as spies. Oh, man. Okay, anyways, wrapping up the tunes. One of the biggest comic strips of all time had to have been Calvin and Hobbes. And you know that
right.
any time you have a property like that, I mean, look at Garfield.
Peanuts. I mean, come on.
Yeah, Peanuts.
Or at least a holiday special. Any type
right.
of animated period will take. And, you know, this is one thing I think Bill Waterston goes down in the all-time club of just of enormous respect of for an artist because he created one of the great creations, I think, in his own medium of Calvin and Hobbes. I mean, something that has touched the lives of millions. And yet, have you ever noticed you don't see Calvin and Hobbes shit at every grocery checkout stand
right.
or some cheap 7-Eleven or whatever toy aisles or, you know, whatever camping gear or whatever. He never merchandised out Calvin and Hobbes. And he never gave over he never approved any type of film or animated versions. Now, I had heard many tests were done, animated tests, for a Calvin and Hobbes animated film / special.
Right.
But in the end, they were all rejected. And I guess, I mean, maybe the trickiest thing of all is how do you do the voice of Hobbes in that sense?
Right.
Even Calvin would be tricky, but Hobbes is supposed to be your voice. So everyone's going to hear something differently. So yeah, that might have been just, you know, one of the obstacles among many. But it would have made a fantastic animated film, considering the imagination of our young hero. But yeah, maybe it was just one of those things that was, you know, better left to the imagination.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I think that'll be, like you said, that respect. And, you know, anytime someone can just take it and run with that cash. But
he could have made $1 billion.
Yeah, absolutely.
$1 billion. But you know what? He was happy being a millionaire or whatever he reached. Like a lot of other cartoonists, you know, he drew every frame of his cartoon. He never hired a staff to do that kind of work, which a lot of, you know, famous comic strips do often do.
Right.
From time to time. So, yeah, I always had a lot of respect for Bill Waterston in that sense. And I do miss the strip, but I have so many volumes to go back and revisit. It's always a treat. The fact that we got so much output. That and The Far Side. You know,
oh,
Gary
man.
Larson's. I mean, you really can't do anything with a film on that because
no.
they're one-panel jokes.
Yeah.
But, yeah, boy, I do miss that, too.
Oh, man, The Far Side. I have the big, gigantic book of everything.
Oh, wow.
It's
nice.
Really awesome. All right, diving over into like the kind of cops crime thriller area of things that we
Oh, you
never
mean
saw.
Thief 2?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nocturnal Fears?
Yeah. Never heard of that one.
No, Thief 2 was called Heat. That's what it was called.
There you go. Yeah, why bring in Robert De Niro? Just let Thief do it.
James Caan?
Just let James Caan be the main guy. Come on. I mean, that's who he was playing. But anyways, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the Lethal Weapon series. And there was talk recently.
Lethal Weapon 5.
And, you know, and there was that little hint of maybe a Shane Black headed film. We know that the man can direct. We've seen it and direct well. We know that he can write well. So really, let's let
him. When I heard that he had done a Lethal Weapon 5 treatment, I'm like you. I'm like, first of all, I want to read it.
Yeah.
But second of all, it's like, I can't think of a better guy to wrap up this show.
Sure.
You know, he was not involved in 3 and 4. And his story was used for part 2, but he was rewritten excessively.
Right.
I think it's perfect now that he can, at least he's got an idea of something to do. I don't even know what his story was. I have no idea the direction it took or what it was. But I know there was a competing project that Richard Donner had, and he had commissioned a script, I think, from Channing Gibson, who wrote Lethal Weapon 4. And it was like a 24 hours in the life of Murtaugh and Riggs kind of cops take on Lethal Weapon.
Right.
Like you were with them almost in real time for this day of hell that they had to go through.
Yeah.
So maybe it was closer to like the Die Hard with a Vengeance screenplay, which I think was originally written as a Lethal Weapon type movie
right.
to begin with. At this point, are we just never going to get a Lethal Weapon 5? Probably.
Well, the heat that Gibson's in right now, I guarantee it. Or because of the heat he's in, we may get it. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's in such trouble.
Do you think they even the studio would take the risk on it? Do you think if, like, Lethal Weapon 5 came out next year, how do you think it fares in the box office?
No, they would never take that chance. I mean, this thing's going to have to blow over for a while. You know, it's going to be years. And at that point, you know, is it even, I mean, they're both.
Never happened. It's never
going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
I mean, they would be so old, they would be like super retired by that point.
That's like me holding my breath out for Mel Gibson in Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
Right?
Even if that could possibly happen, that would never happen now. He's going to be the plague for a while. You know what I mean? But, no, yeah, it's just.
So that is another never happened because George Miller and Mel Gibson were about a month away from shooting Mad Max Fury Road in 2003 until the U.S. invaded Iraq and the dollar shifted in Africa and suddenly production was off and that was the end of that story.
It's George Bush's fault. Everything. That's all you ever hear everywhere. Everything. George Bush, he's like, hey, wait a minute. It was my fault. I want to see another Mad Max movie. Come on.
Hell yeah, he would. He'd be there first day. Just like I would have been.
Oh,
I'd have given anything to go to a movie theater in 2004 and see Mad Max Fury Road with Mel Gibson. That would have been the treat of all treats. That might be the one film on this whole list. There's going to be a couple of them that I would take with me of my most wanted of all of the never happens.
Right, like if you could make one happen.
I mean, Mad Max Fury Road with Gibson is certainly at the top of my list.
All right, continuing the same route. Now, I don't know if this is really talk. Now, I'm taking this from John Jansen, but you had talked to me about, wow, wouldn't it be cool to get another Dirty Harry movie?
Oh, of course. Well, the other film that would be on the top of my list of never happens.
Now, was this really something that was being discussed, or was this just a John Jansen wish?
No, I've actually seen interviews where Eastwood has been open to the idea of doing another one if they could come up with a story for one. And I remember I challenged myself for a while to say, well, what would the story be if you had to do another Dirty Harry? And I always thought it would be interesting if you came up with sort of a... you have to have a reason to get out of retirement, obviously.
Right.
You can't still be on the force.
Right.
But I thought the best reason to get him out of retirement is create a plot where there's a copycat killer. So you recreate some of the Scorpio killings. You recreate some of the cop killings from Magnum Force and the People's Group from The Enforcer. Even some of the vigilante Sandra Locke killings from Sudden Impact. You know, you incorporate those murders and spread them out to where the only connective tissue would be Harry Callahan. So you bring him in as a consultant. In that kind of sense.
Right.
And I always thought it would be kind of funny that when you examine all the partners Harry has had, you know, he's had a Mexican, a partner, he's had an African-American partner, he's had a female partner, he's had a Chinese-American partner. But there's still one partner in San Francisco he's not been partnered with yet.
Don't say it. A gay partner.
And I'm thinking Josh Brolin would be perfect to play it.
No, Val Kilmer.
Something in the gay Perry range. I mean, a tough guy that just happened to be gay. Because Eastwood has a line in Magnum Force that always cracked me up, where they're talking about how well David Soul and Robert Urich and Tim Matheson and all those guys can shoot. And somebody throws a line. It's like, yeah, those guys stuck together so much, everybody thought they were queer.
Everybody thought they were queer for each other.
And Eastwood turns to the guy and says, man, if the rest of the department could shoot as well as they could, like them, I wouldn't care if the whole damn department was queer. So just that one line in Magnum Force to come back on Harry would be funny to me as a Dirty Harry fan. I don't know. I'm sorry.
Spin a whole movie out of that one line.
That one line would pay off so well if he got a gay partner. But it would just be kind of funny, again, if you got like a Josh Brolin and team them up. He's a consultant. Obviously, you would have to have a thicker plot, you know, Labyrinth plot like Chinatown. It would have to be about something bigger than just copycat murders. It would be a land grab. It would be all about real estate. Mm-hmm. And it would be about trying to, you know, drive people out and buy land real cheap in order to build, you know, stadiums and condos and, you know,
all right,
and that kind of thing.
Quit your dreaming, boy. But we'll put it on.
Well, anyway,
we'll put it on your list.
You know, it's never going to happen. So I could pitch a Dirty Harry movie that's never going to happen because it's not. But if it did happen and you asked me and I had to pitch my idea, it would go something like that.
Now, here's another one that I really would love to see. And this is one that's been in development hell for so long. And it's this discussion of a new Fletch movie. And if you remember Fletch, I mean...
I do, yeah.
Just one hell of a great, funny movie. And a good movie, you know, and had an interesting plot. And
it's a series that really should have continued. They should have done another third movie real quick after the failure of the second
right.
one. Even though it wasn't that great, they should have said, you know what? Let's just pick up our boots and do another one. We can do better. Because I think a third one would have been really welcome. Because I think they could have just found a better story in the novels rather than trying to invent their own.
It's just so amazing the way that part two was such a piece of crap. The way that, I mean, it's still got Chevy doing his thing, but really, it's like, even like you would move on to Beverly Hills Cop 2, it's the same thing. They just said, let's just let Chevy do his shtick. That's what's most important.
They wrote the shtick first.
Right.
And then they tried to write the movie around that, and you're always going to get into trouble. And I still think the reason the first film works... I think Andrew Bergman wrote the script, but it works because the script is pretty tight. It's an interesting little murder mystery that he can layer in and do his shtick on top of.
Right.
So no matter where it is, the film is still heading towards a finish line, and Fletch is interwoven enough in it to keep it interesting. I think that's what makes the first movie work as well as it does. And you gotta have that foundation of at least an interesting case for Fletch to be on. And this was just more about how do we get him in another disguise.
Right. Let's get him to do the healing minister evangelist.
But the idea
thing,
you're getting, you know, to, I really like. I like the idea that Kevin Smith had.
And Kevin Smith was one of those fans of Fletch that wanted to see this move forward. And for years he was had written a script, but he was emphatic that no one but Jason Lee could play that character. But at the time, the studio was like, we don't know this Jason Lee character. I mean, we've seen him in a couple things. I mean, wasn't he a skateboard kid or something? I mean, I knew he was a professional mm-hmm. skateboarder before he became an actor. We don't want that. But, you know, later on, when My Name is Earl really took off, and you started to see that, I mean, if anything, Jason Lee always had that same kind of sarcastic, no, not so much in My Name is Earl, but that helped him move up a level in popularity for a while. It had about, I think, four seasons. But if you go back and see some of his work with Kevin Smith, that kind of very sarcastic humor would have been so perfect because it was very similar to what Chevy was doing. And if anything, it really modeled that. And I'm in complete agreement that I think he would have been perfect. They didn't believe in him, so it got in that, so they said, no, we're not going to do your version. And then it just bounced around for so long. Who had the rights? And oh, and there was talk of Zach Braff.
But weren't you saying that they were going to do something that he was Fletch, but it was still Chevy as Fletch? Chevy was going to still be in it?
The good thing about the latest version of what I heard Smith talking about was his idea was not to reboot or to replace, but that it would have been called Son of Fletch, and Chevy would have been Fletch, but Jason Lee would have been his son and would be doing things in his, you know, similar to him, but much like, you know, in the handoff that happened with the black cop. With
Shaft.
With Shaft, right.
Which I always found just satisfactory to me in that, in terms of respecting the original.
Right, you respect the original and you hand off. The handoff is so much better than the replace in a logical sense. And so you can.
And we talk about that Bionic Woman TV series that came out a couple years ago and died a quick death.
Right.
I mean, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
I mean, I have zero interest in watching it. You tell me that Lindsay Wagner and Lee Majors are going to be in the pilot. I am so there. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I'd map out my whole day around making sure I couldn't miss that episode. So I don't know what they were thinking there. That was a perfect opportunity. And again, to bring Richard Anderson in and to do the handoff.
Right, do the handoff.
And you can just sprinkle them back in occasionally. It would have been just perfect. There was even room for the bionic dog.
Well, but the person, the bionic dog. We got to have Bigfoot too then. Well, but you got to remember the people behind the Bionic Woman remake were the people behind the Battlestar Galactica reboot.
I know. It's all about making it brand new.
Exactly.
I know.
And they were going on that same route. We're going to make it brand new.
Well,
and
it worked out so well for them.
Yeah. It's really too bad. I would have loved to see Fletch continue. There was talk of Zach Braff. There's been different actors attached, different directors.
See, that's so funny is they don't want Jason Lee, but they want Zach Braff.
Yeah, and I don't see that.
I don't see him as like a movie star. I mean, I see him as a TV star.
Yeah. So,
but
well,
really
he had kind
sense.
Of that smartassy humor in Scrubs, and I think
yeah,
that's
it's
what they
snappy.
Saw.
It's that snappy kind of smartass, and
yeah.
Well, when people write you that kind of dialogue, you know, boom, you could knock it right out of the park. But no, I like the Jason Lee Fletch. I think a little bit better, and I think he'd have been just right with Chevy. It had good chemistry.
Absolutely. Now, one thing that you and I talked about, it never happened because there was falling out and the project kind of fell into a different way, is what happened with Godfather 3.
Oh, yes. Well, this is the one that creeps in on my Mad Max Fury Road and Dirty Harry, is the Godfather 3 that coulda, shoulda happened.
Right.
Coppola has a script written, and it originally did contain Tom Hagen, who, I mean, that's all I had to say. Anyone that knows The Godfather knows exactly what I am talking about mm-hmm. here. A key, key character to the entire saga, to the family, to the emotional core, I think, of the entire series. And the fact that it didn't happen over money is one of the saddest tragedies, I think, of that particular film. Because you put Robert Duvall in Godfather 3 in the original script that he wrote, because he wrote a script that Tom Hagen was a central character. No, he did not have John Savage as a son who goes off to the church and all that other kind of stuff. And no, there was no George Hamilton. This was a Tom Hagen role, and he was central to the plot. So anyway, the original Mario Puzo, Francis Ford Coppola script for Godfather 3 had a Tom Hagen plot. He was a central character to the story. And from what I remember, and I'm a little fuzzy on this, but the deal was, is Paramount wanted Godfather 3, but only if it could hit theaters for Christmas 1990.
Right.
So somewhere around November 89... they made a deal with Francis Ford Coppola, and they said, okay, yes, you can write it, you can direct it, and you can do anything you want, but it must be in cinemas by Christmas 1990. So in a year, you know, he had to write the script, he had to set up the production, he had to shoot it, and he had to edit it and get it out. And, you know, him and Puzo knocked out a screenplay, and I think it was a good story that they had. And I really like reading the original story because I think it was a little bit deeper in terms of the plot line with the church and its financial troubles and, you know, sort of the path of redemption for Michael Corleone and so forth. But unfortunately, this is one of the great losses never happens because Godfather 3 takes a beating. And it's tough when you're the little brother of two geniuses like Godfather and Godfather Part 2.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It's almost like being Ringo Starr in the Beatles or something, you know. It's a tough rap that Godfather 3 takes. Unfortunately, it seems to be a lot of, I think because Tom Hagen is not there, our attention shifts, and I think so much shifted on Sofia Coppola and her performance as Mary, and that became everybody's sort of whipping post on the movie and the backlash. I think ultimately, because, you know, the lack of Tom Hagen, I think if he had been in it, I think the weight of the film would have shifted so much, it would have balanced out any other issues I think people had with that particular movie. But, you know, who knows? If Coppola had a little bit longer to work on it, massage it, and so forth, you know, it's hard to say, but it's a definite never happened.
What was Duvall's reason for not being there?
It was money.
Uh-huh.
Pacino was being paid a lot of money at the time. Even Diane Keaton was making something like $1 million for a salary or $2 million, a lot of money for a female actress in a film, for sure. And Duvall wanted his fee.
Right.
And Coppola was like, we don't have it. We don't have enough to meet your fee. I need you to do this for me, you know, for whatever fee they were offering. And Tom Cruise offered him his full fee, but plus to go do Days of Thunder. And, you know, Duvall went and did that film instead.
Great.
But, you know, I think from Duvall's perspective, it's like, you come to my table and you insult me with this offer.
Yeah.
I'm Robert fucking Duvall. I was the guy on the fucking beach talking about napalm in the morning, all right? Yes. I bled for you, Francis.
That's true. That's true. He had been there.
You bleed for me. You need to bleed for me now, you know? And I tell you what, if I was Francis, I would have cut my salary. Although that's the whole reason he couldn't. The whole reason he did Godfather 3 is so he could get himself out of debt. I mean, that's the reason that movie happened. At that time, Coppola was vulnerable, and they did make him an offer he couldn't refuse. But that was a big part of him restructuring his life and getting his winery in order, and it allows him to be the filmmaker he is today. He absolutely made the right decisions. I'm not saying he made the wrong ones. It's just unfortunate because I think a few different decisions, and we would have had a superior Godfather 3.
Well, that, and also had Winona Ryder not gotten sick or had to bail on the project.
That would have been really interesting, what the perceptions of would have been all the way around.
Right.
I mean, it's one of those great never happens. But, I mean, I still like the film. I mean, it's just tough when you're the, you know, when you're the three-star film in a series of 2 4-star films.
Well, I hardly think that it makes the movie suck altogether.
No, I just think that that character had a lot of family weight. And when you just throw George Hamilton in, it's off-putting.
Right.
Even for a Godfather fan, even for a hardcore Godfather fan, it's like, who is this guy and what is this? And Tom Hagen's son goes nowhere as a plot point.
Right.
It's more of a distraction than anything. It's not very satisfying, I think, overall.
All right, moving on. Now, here's a funny question I have for you. How many different directors and visions do we have for the Mission Impossible films? There was this development process that went on. I remember there was Fincher involved, Joe Carnahan, Oliver Stone is in this mix somewhere.
You know, I think, you know, Cruise again. I mean, look at the thinking of the Mission Impossible series, getting Brian De Palma, getting John Woo. It seems really natural that they would look to another type filmmaker like Oliver Stone to say, hey, do you want to come in and try this type of movie? You've never made a movie like this before. And Oliver Stone apparently worked on a screenplay, worked on an idea, but parted ways. And then Fincher came on, and that shocked everybody. It's like, what's Fincher doing?
Right.
You know, why is he getting into this mess and so forth? And they developed an idea that got to a certain point, and I guess that they parted ways. And then Joe Carnahan spends a year or more of his life working on his version of Mission Impossible 3 that doesn't make it either.
It's like this great test.
So you got three never happens in a row before JJ comes in with his Alias team and cranks that one up and out real quick.
And makes Alias the movie with a dude instead of a chick.
Well, you know, he knows his formula, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's, I mean, it made sense. If I was Tom Cruise and I was home watching an episode of Alias, I would have said, wait a minute. Exactly. That great moment of recognition. This is the guy.
I wonder what his production offices must be like. There must be like a whole shelf dedicated to Mission Impossible and all the rejected scripts.
Yeah, all the different versions leading up to it. So, well, and we'll see. We got another one coming now with Brad Bird. I mean, what a great choice as a director.
It's a very exciting choice for him to make his live action debut in that way, but I mean, look what it did for JJ.
Right.
It launched his career in a huge way, and Star Trek just cemented it. So no, I think it's a good challenge, because I think Brad Bird has proven that he can jump into an established genre and do something unique, funny, exciting, suspenseful, and just overall entertaining.
Sure.
Inside that genre, I've got complete faith up to a point. Because we don't know. I mean, that's the problem with these big franchise movies, is that's just what they are. And the more expensive they get, the more towards the middle they go, and, you know, they lose more of their interesting flavor when the studio starts calling the shots. But, you know, we got to give a little faith in, hopefully, that they have something that'll work and they'll be allowed to execute on it.
Now, one of the things is we've talked about various directors hopping in and off of projects. It was interesting to me when we've heard these little rumors of certain directors having certain passion projects or coming up with really grand ideas that almost were ideas that set things in motion. I'm thinking of particularly of Quentin Tarantino when he had this idea about doing Casino Royale with Pierce Brosnan.
I remember reading about this, that Quentin was definitely interested in going back to the novel. He was interested in doing a low-budget Bond, $40 million, real lean, not a lot of action, character-orientated, but he wanted Brosnan. And he got a chance, I think, to pitch this to the Broccolis. He says that they stole his idea and went off and did Casino Royale. For years, Casino Royale was the one novel the Broccolis did not own the rights to.
Right.
And that was a stickling point. And then through some shifts of ownership, they got a chance to buy the rights to that. And they did.
Right.
So they got ownership on it, and I guess that put in motion, you know, the eventual production that came out of it. But I think the idea of bringing in a Tarantino is exciting.
I think that's the interesting thing, is what would have been like to compare those Casino Royales is, you know, we know the Casino Royale that we have that we love.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
one of the best Bonds.
Right, which would have been very different, though, however, from Tarantino's kind of Pierce Brosnan thing. Interesting, you know, when you think about that and how it turned out. I'm kind of, even though I would be very interested to see QT's take on Bond, I still love what we got. So I almost wouldn't want to trade that in, even just to see as a curiosity. Now, if you remember, and I don't know how these ideas get out. I don't know how they get spun. I don't know if this is just all bullshit hearsay, but you remember there was also this Quentin Tarantino discussion about a Beverly Hills Cop reboot, or Beverly Hills Cop 4, if you will.
Yeah, that one I don't remember. I do remember the Vega brothers was always getting tossed around. I always figured that was a never happen project anyway, doing a film about Vincent Vega and his brother, played by Michael Madsen in Reservoir Dogs.
Right. And then
Vic Vega.
Right, right. And
Toothpick Vic.
And they said they were going to... He talked about making this film?
It was a prequel.
Okay.
Obviously.
Right.
But for both characters before their respective exits in each of those films.
Obviously.
But, yeah, I mean, apparently he had an idea kicking around, but I think the idea gestated too long. The characters got too old. And what are you going to do now? It'd just be fun if he wrote it out. Because, again, Quentin's a good enough writer where you could just read one of his screenplays and it's almost like you saw the movie.
Right.
Almost. Not completely, but you really do get a good portion of what kind of color he had in mind. But, about his Beverly Hills Cop 4, I don't know what his pitch was or what his idea was. Not at all.
But I think that was, somehow I remember reading something on it and thinking, well, if anyone's going to do it, I would love for him to do that. You know, instead some other retarded route, like, say, a Brett Ratner.
Instead of what, Brett Ratner?
Oh, God. Yeah, I can't wait for that one. I really hope that never happens.
Well, I've read the current Beverly Hills Cop 4 screenplay that they've been floating around to make, and I hope it doesn't happen.
Well, but then again, 3 never really happened, did it?
Yeah, no. I mean, and again, I think, you know, the series needs to get back to what made the first one work. Someone needs to write a good, serious detective story that you can insert Axel Foley into.
Right.
And then find those energetic, humorous sort of avenues. And, I mean, okay, since we're pitching here, I'll do the Jansen pitch right now.
There we go.
And I would call it Detroit City Cops. My pitch is opening scene, Axel is tied to a chair, and someone's beating the shit out of him, asking him to reveal information about a witness. And Axel's just laughing up a storm. He won't reveal anything. So the guy turns around and breaks his middle finger. Right out there, first scene of the movie, and Axel's howling and laughing in pain. And he's going to have to wear a freaking cast on his middle finger for half the movie. Only half, but at least half. And, of course, you know, Jeffrey and the rest of the guys are outside the warehouse. They come in too late. Big shootout happens. And anyway, Axel doesn't give up the girl, but a lot of shit goes down wrong.
Right.
So he's going to have to take a suspension, of course. He's going to be booted out.
Of course.
And he's going to know too much. Of course he will. So when he's down on his lowest and the cops don't trust him and he needs the most help he can get, he calls in a favor from Billy and Taggart, who have to come to Detroit. They are the fish out of water now. Now they work with Axel through the underbelly of Detroit to try to solve, you know, again, some, you know, serpentine plot. You know, I always go back to the Robert Town Chinatown plot, one of the greatest ever. Just start from there, you know. Wound your hero some way. And Shane Black was thinking about it, too, when he wrote Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I promise you. But, you know, you got to find some way to wound your hero so we can, you know, as his journey continues, he's always carrying that with him. So I always thought Axel with a cast on his middle finger would be kind of fun.
You mean that fucking finger that got cut off in the door?
I know.
Is that my finger on the floor? Yeah, I'm going to pick it up. Oh, man.
But anyway, Beverly Hills Cop 4, well, my version will never happen, of course. But that's what I think you do. You flip it. You don't send him back to Beverly Hills. That's the worst thing you can do.
Right.
We've done it. It was so tired by number 3. Make a Detroit City Cop movie. Well, I want to see how good of a cop he was in Detroit. And bring in Billy and Taggart as a fish out of water for them. That would make it interesting. We haven't seen that before. Otherwise, do what they always talked about. Send them to fucking Europe. You know?
Yeah.
That was the originally Beverly Hills Cop 2 anyway. Was Axel Foley in Europe. And really, they probably should have done that movie instead of just the rehash they did for number 2 as it was.
Right.
But, you know, another never happened.
Oh, yeah,
never
will. Well, and continuing on QT, remember, there's this discussion, and we don't know if it ever will happen, but it seems pretty far-fetched that we'll do another Kill Bill movie one day. I know that the whole setup...
He likes to hint at it.
I know, but the whole setup when Beatrix is talking to the little daughter of one of the ladies, one of the chicks she killed, and she's saying, you know, one day you'll want to come after me and I'll be ready. So that's the whole setup. It's like
a 2.5-hour movie about one fight.
Yeah. It's just like,
come on. That's a lot of talking just to get them going at it. I don't know.
It's just not necessary. You know, it's just whatever. But looking still at these directors, you know, Coppola had tried to make this Megapolis, and I know that some of you have heard of that.
Megapolis, yeah. Another screenplay that I was able to read recently. And again, I just think it's one of those projects that just...
it was too big.
It wasn't within his grasp to try and... a little bit too big, too ambitious. You know, I think he was still tooling around on the script, hadn't quite gotten everything to where he wanted it to be. That's the great thing about ambition. You know, you never know. He might realize it someday.
Right.
As it becomes cheaper to realize some of those digital effects, he might be able to actually put his vision that he had in mind for that project.
Now, I'm going to flip over to Linklater real quick for a second, Richard Linklater. And, you know, we've seen two Sunrise movies before, Sunrise, Sunsets.
Right.
And will the story continue? I think that probably...
Will that be a never happen?
Will that be a never happen? Obviously, we know that everyone involved would probably return for something like that, Ethan Hawke and such. And I think maybe everyone...
Well, you can say it did happen. Did you see Waking Life? They got a nice little bedroom scene in Waking Life. So if you consider that scene in Waking Life to take place after Before Sunset, there you have your coda. You
know. Right. So there you go. So it may have, yeah, you got a touch on there. So
no, but I've heard them talk about it, that they would like to all, if they could find the right idea and come up with it, that they'd like to do it again. And apparently all three of them collaborate on the screenplay
sure.
for Before Sunset. So you're going to get the interjection of three different voices. And, of course, Ethan and Julie are going to know their characters as well or better than anybody
sure.
in terms of their emotional growth and feelings. So, yeah, I cheer that project on, and I'm willing to be patient and wait for it because, you know, just like the second one and how it just kind of came out of nowhere, I never would have guessed that there would have ever been a follow-up. That would have been a never happened if I would have, you know, you would have asked me, like, in the, you know, after 95 when... Before Sunrise came out, it's like, will there ever be a sequel to that? Never happened.
Right.
You know, I never would have imagined it. And so I love being wrong about something like that and being completely
right,
surprised.
Right, and getting that so. Gift. Now, another thing with Linklater mm-hmm. was, you know, I've talked before about getting a chance to meet him and such, and that one of the things he talked about was going and doing his Texas high school football movie. And really, it was kind of
right.
like, you know, are we going to ever see that Richard Linklater Friday Night Lights type of a film. It kind of got
it's
done.
It's too bad because he was going to do Friday Night Lights. That was going to be... He was one of the original directors on that project. From what I understand, he was 4 or 6 weeks away from starting principal photography
wow.
on his Friday Night Lights when it got pulled on him. Mm. He was close
right.
to getting it done. He had a script, but... Yeah, the project got canceled. It never happened. And then Peter Berg picked it up and was able to take it to the finish line and then turn it into, I think, the format that was probably best for that subject matter anyway, which was the television series format.
Right.
Where I think that you really do have time to explore the different facets of the ensemble cast of characters. Because I always felt that the movie always was kind of rushed in so many ways.
Right.
Just because it has to be. Even in a 2-hour, 15-minute framework, you're still going to have to rush a lot of plot points along. So, again, I would love to see what he would have done with it. I'd still love to see his football movie someday. I know he got his baseball movie out of his system with Bad News Bears.
Right.
Although that's probably not the baseball movie he always thought he was going to make.
Right.
It was probably a fun opportunity to get to make one. Because those are tough genres. I mean, those are... Sports genres notoriously don't make money because they don't play overseas that well.
Right.
So if you don't really make it in America, it's really tough to sort of justify the extended box office for those types of films. So when they come along, it is rare. And that was always going to be the big deal about Friday Night Lights is they were never going to win.
Yeah.
I mean, that was always the plot of the whole thing. No matter what, if you're going to make that book, they have to lose at the end. So... You know, you're already fighting that uphill battle.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how many meanings? It's like that Ben Stiller. But what if they don't lose?
Yes. Exactly.
But what if they don't?
But they do.
But what if they don't?
But what if they don't? Well, let me switch off the directors here and go to writers for a second. Because you know, over the years, and like you really said, you really nailed this in the beginning, was talking about all those great screenplays that, you know, have gone unwritten or unfilmed, that were written but mm-hmm. never filmed, never made it there. And one of our really most prolific screenwriters, and it was so huge throughout the 90s and such, was Joe Esterhaus. And, you know, he's had scripts that... They got passed around. Are we going to make this? And they get, you know, almost there. But I know there's a couple that you have been talking to me about.
Oh, he's got a whole shelf full of unrealized projects. I mean,
yeah.
Gangland about John Gotti. He's got other ones about the music industry that he's written. I mean, after Basic Instinct sold for a record sums amount of money.
Right.
everybody was buying Esterhaus stuff. You know, anything that came off his typewriter was just getting sold. He sold a pitch to New Line for One Night Stand for almost $4 million. A pitch.
Man.
That Mike Figgis reworked into a movie that was so different from Esterhaus's original pitch that, you know, he didn't even ask for credit on it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this guy was really, really hot. And two of the projects that have always stayed with me that I thought were really interesting were Sacred Cows and Male Pattern Baldness. Two really dark, almost you could call black comedy style scripts of the type that just don't get through the system that often when you're this brutal as sort of the... the tack that these scripts kind of go on. But the premise for Sacred Cows is a one of a kind. And I guess you would almost have to be someone successful like Esterhaus, who's already written Jagged Edge and Flashdance and Music Box and Betrayed and all these other, and, you know, even Basic Instinct that sells for a lot of money. But Sacred Cows has a date on the script that says April Fool's 1990. And that's when he turned this script in. And it did sell for a lot of money at the time. It's about an older president who's facing re-election. And he's a good old boy, old country boy. I don't know, from Nebraska or some farm state. And he's in a bit of trouble with India on different kind of issues that are going on during this time period. And he goes on a tour, campaign tour, and he goes back to a farm, and it reminds him of his old, of the feeling he had when he was growing up. And it's a very comforting sort of place that takes him back. And as he falls asleep in a barn one night, he wakes up and finds a cow and reminisces about his youth, and he's a little drunk at the time, and he screws the cow. I'll repeat that for everyone that just didn't believe it, but he screws the cow. And someone takes a photograph of it, okay? So here you have a president who, in his weakest moment, did something that outrageous, and then someone got a photograph, and now they're threatened to blackmail him. And if he doesn't, you know, drop out or do whatever, you know, is necessary. And, of course, India's outraged because the cow being
right.
their sacred animal.
Right.
That's thrown a lot of things. The shit's hit the fan, if you will. But something outrageous happens. He decides to not give in to what the blackmailers want and what everyone else is telling him to do. He decides to go out and be honest. And he admits to the entire thing. And he apologizes to the entire country of India and all the people. And he apologizes to the American people, explains the situation and what happened. And all of this, I guess, happens on election night. And this is with the fable aspect. But everyone is just so astonished with his honesty and with how he handles the situation. He wins re-election in a landslide.
So message being, Clinton, if you would have just admitted it.
Well, this is the funny thing. The script has a date of 1990. So it's pre-Clinton completely.
Well, then it doesn't even count.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because in 1991, the director that had signed on to direct this little Dr. Strangelovian type project was none other than Steven Spielberg.
Oh, my God. What a choice.
Spielberg was going to make this movie. He had told Joe Esterhaus he wants to make it. He was gung-ho all about it. And then Clinton became president.
Oh.
And Spielberg became friendly with the Clintons as a family.
Uh-huh.
And once that happened, he did not feel comfortable making this movie at that time. And he begged off of it. And many a director has tried to mount. You like that? And something always inevitably keeps it to getting to even the starting gate. You know, I don't even think it ever gets out of the gate. I just think it, you know, either, and this is the one thing about Joe Esterhaus, he's really adamant, is you don't rewrite my shit.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You know, I'm the composer. You know, the director is the conductor, and the actors are the saxophone players or the guitarists or whatever musicians you want. You know, but you will conduct my symphony the way I wrote it, and I don't want you changing shit, okay? So you can't find the soft way around a Joe Esterhaas project. You either got to go in, balls in, and do the whole thing. And if you shoot his script word for word, and you're Paul Verhoeven, you get a $400 million hit like Basic Instinct.
Right.
But if you're William Friedkin and you start jerking around with Jade and start changing things, you get a flop like Jade. So, you know, buyer beware, I guess, of what you get when you take on an Esterhaas. But Sacred Cows, I mean, it's so outrageous. Obviously, it's a political fable in that kind of sense.
Sure.
And satirical. There's no other way that you could do it. But it's notorious. It's been around now, you know, going on 20 years, still unmade.
Well, but
probably never will.
You never know, but probably never happened. But
it seems like a perfect HBO thing. You do it for the right price,
right?
You could, if you got the right cast in it. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe if Paul Newman would have played it or something, you know, it'd have to be really outrageous. But I don't know. I don't know who you could get, but it would be interesting if you could pull it off.
I think
for sure.
I think if you had to hire someone today, man, put the Coens on it.
Oh, the Coens could do it. I think they have the right sensibilities. You're right. I think they could.
I think they could. I think that's the guys that could pull it off. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Well, we'll see. I hope it happens.
it's one of the wilder screenplays I've had the privilege to read.
Could you imagine the day of the shooting, though, if they ever did that? You know, okay, today's the day you fuck the cow.
I mean, you got to hand it to Joe Esterhaas. What balls to write something like that and throw it out there, and people still want to give you $1.5 million for
crazy,
it. You know?
Crazy.
I mean, good for him. There was that window of opportunity, and he took advantage of it. The other script that he wrote that I've always found really interesting as a concept, and I think is almost a film we need today, and again, it's 20 years old now, too, is Male Pattern Baldness. Now, this is a quote from Joe Esterhaas himself about Male Pattern Baldness I got from an interview on The Onion, and this is what he describes about the project. Male Pattern Baldness was about a guy who lives in the Midwest and works in a steel plant, who finds himself in a battle with all precepts of political correctness. He's just an ordinary guy who goes up against all the sort of politically inspired and enforced social rules that we've looked at in the past 20 years. Everything goes to hell for him. He loses his wife as a result, he loses his son, and he has to take anger management classes. Ultimately, he can't take it. The tone of the piece until now is comedic. It's dark, and it has a really striking comedic tone to the point where Betty Thomas, who directs comedies like Private Parts and The Late Show, after reading it, decided she was going to make it. Suddenly, near the end of the piece, the comedic tone startlingly ends, and he goes on a rampage and kills 4 or 5 of his workers and kills himself. The movie ends with an epilogue of irony. Betty's take and the studio's take when I sold the script was that it was very hard-hitting, and it was certainly going to be very controversial. It proved to be so controversial, finally, in the studio's view, and also Betty's, she felt that it was an assault on political correctness, that they opted not to do the picture, and it was still up on the shelf. I do think that it would have startled some people, and I think it would have made us take a hard look at the effects of political correctness.
Of course it would have been an assault on political correctness. Are you kidding? That's the whole reason that he wrote it.
I've been able to get my hands on a script, a version of the script, I should call it. It has written by Joe Esterhaas on it, but also has revisions by 2 other writers. And I'm guessing this was the version that went into development, because I think it pretty much follows an Esterhaas tone for 2 acts, and then it shifts. And I can tell you right now, in true Hollywood fashion, he does not go on a killing rampage in this version of the script.
Yeah, I bet.
In fact, he reevaluates his life. He tries to get back in with his wife. He goes to all kinds of extremes to prove his love to her. And it ends on a hopeful, happy, hopefully type
ending. Oh, how nice.
And I think it's just indicative of how Hollywood thinks about this, is we can't show you the consequences version. You know, we have to show you the version about what you should do and how you can change your life and how things can get better, like this character did. We can't show you the sad consequences of if you continue down on this path, this is what's going to happen, I guess, is the kind of difference. You know, we don't take to that at the multiplex very well. What's so interesting about the tone of the script is how the lead character is so innocently drawn into all this. I mean, this is a guy that's been working on airplane engines for 30 years. His father did the same job he did for the same kind of company. And his father was a racist, bigot, loudmouth drinker. As much as the son did not want to try and become his dad, of course he becomes his dad. And he's just as estranged from his own son in many ways, and his own wife, and his own marriage. It's almost like he doesn't even have the social tools that we take for granted every day because of his environment and how he grew up and what he had to do to take care of himself and his family and just to survive. But it's simple little things, like one of his co-workers who should have been watching this gasket on a plane was not paying attention, and it blew and it cost them, like, they had to ground all these planes that day. And so he goes up to the guy, and the guy's munching on a bag of Fritos. And he goes, hey, stop eating those Fritos. You need to pay attention to your fucking job. You could have cost us all blah, 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 you know. And he is friendly with the guy, but he's his boss, and he has to be hard on him. But it's the fact that he used the word Fritos. That's his first mistake. Because his supervisor wants to cover his ass and then calls him into the office and said, we don't condone that kind of behavior. You can't call a co-worker Fritos because he was Hispanic. And he's like, I wasn't calling him Fritos. He was actually eating Fritos. And it doesn't matter. And then they call to him. It's like, well, there was an incident last year where you walked up to a stewardess and asked her, are you gay? And he says, but I thought her name was Gay. So you can kind of see how this is stacking right up against him. It's almost like no matter what he can do, because of the way we look at political correctness and how the rules have changed and how sensitive these areas can get, and everyone is just trying to cover their ass, mostly, as you would expect in corporate environments. But it does spiral downwards for him in many sort of really sad ways, and he does try to go through anger management. But it just makes things worse in some kind of ways, because nobody can see anything from his perspective at all. And that's sort of the sad, I guess, tragic irony of the piece. And I mean, that's a hardcore thing to end your movie when you go on that kind of killer rampage. I think of just the opening of the Rapture and how hard-hitting it is in that movie.
Right.
Remember?
Sure.
I just think that I understand why he's going there. And it's almost like it's the cautionary tale. And sometimes you have to tell those every now and then. And when you commit to it, you go full throttle. You go all the way. And you do shake up audiences when they see it. But you get people thinking and talking about it. And I think, yeah, that's exactly what this picture would have done had it was made. It definitely would have started a conversation. And maybe that would have been just enough, because the subject is ripe for it.
Well, look where we are today. We would be ripe for something like that because we are so consumed today with political correctness. And really, that kind of thing would play today. And, you know, it really depends on where you sit on the subject. But in today's Hollywood system, you're right, that would never get made. And if it was made, it would be turned into a romantic comedy instead of something else. It would be You Can Be Forgiven or something, even though, you know.
Oh, I could completely feel the development notes when I was reading this draft.
Sure.
Because there's edge in it, to be sure. But it's always softened in other places. It's never really allowed to stay on that tone.
Well, that's what Esterhaus was always about, was being hardcore and to the bone. And really, you know, he's obviously has a statement here that he wanted to make. Like I said, it's how far they're willing to go. And that's a whole other issue that we could talk about today, is that maybe in a different time, maybe in the 70s, you would have seen something like that, the cautionary tale. But now it's got to be entertainment. Mm-hmm. Now it's got to be fun entertainment and able to make loads of popcorn money.
So nowadays, Travis Bickle, he doesn't need to drive over to where Harvey Keitel and the other pimps are and rescue Iris. He can just go to his self-help group, right?
Exactly.
And get more in touch with his feelings so he doesn't have to go on a
bloodbath. Oh, please. You're so right.
We would. There's no way we would get the films that we did back then today. And that's sick and sad and twisted, and it breaks my heart.
You could do this film. It would just have to be done for like $2 or $5 million.
Right.
And again, maybe cable would be the safest place to do it, but you would have to do it as a small, independent-minded film. And you just, you can't make a film like this and think that, okay, we're going to hit a home run blockbuster with it.
No, but that's the pervasive attitude in Hollywood today. It's all got to be blockbusters.
Yeah. You need a studio that would really get behind it, like a Lionsgate or... Right. You know, like the old New Line or like the old Miramax that would do something that kind of edgy.
Sure.
And actually find theaters for it to play in and make sure it had a chance to breathe and get noticed.
Sure.
But, yeah, sadly, that kind of market is dried up, too. I mean, so I don't know if there's a place for a film like this today. I think there absolutely is. You get the right director to do it and do it right. It could be a film that, you know, we would certainly be talking about on the Saloon. So,
well, again, it's, you know, we're looking at a whole other genre of films that never happened today, that won't happen today in this climate for a while. So that's definitely a never happened. That's really, like you said, heartbreaking. Now, I'm going to flip real quick over here to kind of naming a couple off. We don't even have to talk about them much, but you know we've heard of them. You know, there was always discussion and hope that Newman and Redford would get back together for a third film, and that never happened.
Yeah, that was always my hope, too. And that was always a challenge I would put myself out as a writer. I remember I even asked you a couple times. It's like, all right, if you had to come up with a Newman-Redford project, what would it be?
Yeah.
You know? And that's a tough nut to crack by not just repeating what they already did in the other two films. You know,
right.
It was hard not to cast them as some type of outlaws pulling off a con of some sort.
Exactly.
You know? It was just the only one that I ever thought that could have worked, but they already did it, was Tough Guys. Remember with Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas?
Right.
But if you could do a movie about two old guys getting out of prison as the first scene in the movie, and they've been in for 30 years, well, the whole world has changed so much. If you went into prison in the 70s and came out like in the 90s or 2000s, I mean, can you imagine
right. The
kind of leap that would be?
Huge, huge.
So, you know, that you could, that would be a starting point kind of deal. But no, I'd heard that there was a project that Redford was going to direct that they were going to do, but Newman had to beg off of it because of health reasons. They just waited too long. About a year or two too long,
right. And
it never happened.
That's too
but
bad.
There was a final project they were going to do together,
right?
And sadly, it will never be.
Well, and you know that we lost John Hughes recently, and that was such a heartbreak. But you know, there had been discussion of maybe seeing some sequels to some of his beloved films from the 80s.
I love the idea of like the 32 Candles or something like that.
Right.
That seems like a good one to kind of dive into safely. That you could do. I think, you know, you wouldn't be treading on too much if you just tried to see what that character had been up to all the years later. Breakfast Club is a tougher nut to crack.
Right. That's the one that I always thought of, was I want to know what happened to these characters. How were they the next day? How were they, you know, a year later?
Of course. But don't you know that isn't that the reason why that film even still resonates with us?
Sure.
Is nobody that walked out of that film got that answer, but everybody that walked out of that film came up with that answer.
true.
And that's power, man, that when a film could do that over you, because he couldn't show us. He couldn't.
Right.
Because it would break our heart to see what happened on Monday. It would break our heart after everything we went through. Because the reality is, Monday morning, they ain't talking to each other. They're right back into their zones. If I remember high school honestly, you know, not high school in a movie, but real high school.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But, you know, it's always one of those fascinating things. I've always heard the idea about the reunion concept. And if I had to pitch it off the top of my head, my idea would be something about a reunion, which would bring them together. And for some reason, they would all say, hey, let's go take a look at the library just for old memories. You know, so they break off with the rest. They go into the library and somehow they get locked in there. Okay.
Yeah.
And so while they're waiting for someone to come get out, they just have conversations about their lives before they got to that point. They could bring up that Monday, what actually happened,
right.
Resentments they've held and whatnot. But the whole key to the movie was, is at the end, we would find out that Ally Sheedy's character really orchestrated the whole thing. She was a psychiatrist, and somehow she figured this all out. She got them trapped in there. So she was really manipulating the whole thing behind the scenes, I guess, if you will. So that would be my pitch, you know. Again, never happened, and it shouldn't, because I don't know if there really is a surefire way to make it work, and you certainly couldn't do it without the voice of John Hughes.
No, you can't do it without John Hughes.
I don't know if he ever wrote a script. I would love to read it.
Yeah.
That would be like one of my top reads. I would love to read if it actually existed out there. But it's so perfect without it. Just thinking about it makes it perfect and untouchable.
It does, but in the same way that we got the Sunrise Sunset movies, okay?
You're right.
And because they're so talky, you know, I think I really like your pitch, because I think that would be the way to do it. Do it at the reunion and have them get locked up in there. It's quaint and nice that they get locked up, but the way that you make it not stupid that they got locked up there by accident is that it wasn't, you know, orchestrated. So
Totally.
So, yeah, absolutely. I like that. Now, damn it, I want to see it.
But who could write it? I mean, that's the thing is, it's you got to find the right things for them to say, and what are they going to bring up, and what are they going to talk about and do, and it's a mighty challenge. I mean, that goes beyond the pitch, because that's the heart of what makes that first movie so powerful.
Right.
It is a great concept in itself, and it sustains itself on that concept for 30 minutes, but then it has to shift,
right?
And then it goes into a lot of other areas, and that's, you know, I think the strength and power in that film. But it is great that all the actors are still with us.
Sure.
Except for Paul Gleason, of course. That would have been...
I got you, Binda.
You know, that would have been the one.
Maybe, well...
But John Capellos is still with us, you know?
The janitor?
Carl. Yeah, Carl would have to be there, right? He's the one that would... See, Carl would be in on it with Ally Sheedy's character, so he would unlock the door at the
very end. He'd still be the janitor, though.
He'd be the principal, you know?
And then, you know, I've always had a curiosity. What would have happened with Ferris Bueller? I don't know that I needed to see that movie, but I certainly would like to know what kind of hijinks he would pull as an adult. Certainly he would be rich somewhere. But, you know, that's another fun one that I could dream of.
I mean, you could go down the list. You could go down to the Pretty in Pinks or Some Kind of Wonderfuls and all that. But those feel more self-contained to me. To where, you know, I don't know if you'd really need to revisit those characters.
Because
they were more stock and situational.
A couple more to knock off here real quick. There was talk of Richard Donner being involved with the grown-up Goonies for a while. And while that's interesting, you know, I don't know. I mean, I also heard, I remember reading that it's just there's no budget for it. There's no real pull for that other than, you know, really diehard fans and, you know, grown-up adults who grew up with
that. Well, in this whole age of reboot and remakes, what difference does it make? Just call it The Goonies, The Next Generation. Some kids will treat it like their first Goonie movies, and all the other kids will be like, wow, this is the movie I've always wanted them to make. It's like you hit both demographics.
I think the desire was not as a remake, but as a...
No, as a follow-up. It should be the kids
right.
of the kids. That's
go.
All.
There you go.
So you get to make a new Goonies movie out of it, is what I'm saying. So for your son that doesn't know anything about the Goonies, you could take him to see this movie, and it would be a standalone Goonies movie. But for you, it would be a sequel, because it would be all your
right.
other characters and their kids, and they would be involved in the plot, too. So you get the best of both worlds.
Right. Yeah, interesting, but never happened, probably.
Never going to happen.
Yeah, probably
right.
not going to happen. And there was a Dances with Wolves 2 book written.
Michael Blake wrote the screenplay. I've read it, yeah.
Right. It was called The Holy Road, and it was like, I don't know, 10, 11 years later or something, and it was the continuing story of what happened with John Dunbar and Stands with a Fist. And, you know, I don't know, a film, not necessary. I mean, I don't know. I mean, would people have seen it? Sure. Could it still happen? Yeah, probably, if Costner wanted to go that way.
Oh, it's going to happen. It'll just be called Avatar 2. Oh, sorry.
there you go.
Think about Kevin Costner. He's never done a sequel.
Yeah.
I mean, he could have, easily.
Sure.
I'm sure he's been offered a bunch. But, yeah, no, he's never gone that route. So, yeah, I mean, It's a tricky one because that was, you know, a beloved film, or it was when it came out, but I think it still is.
I love it, yeah.
But, you know, again, if it's a good script and it's a good movie, then I think it's got potential for sure. So, yeah, it's just whether or not you you can get the principals involved. And, you know, the tricky thing is there's always that time factor of does too much time go by
right
before it really makes sense to do the sequel? Like, how long is too long to where you blew it? You waited too long. Because you can't just put a movie out called Kevin Costner, The Holy Road. Yeah. I mean, that'll turn out to be the Evening Star.
I know. God, it's like no one even knew that that was a sequel to Terms of Endearment.
So that's, you could face that.
Yeah.
That would be tough.
Yeah. Interesting, interesting. Only a couple others I have here. Remo Williams returns.
Right. Where is my Remo Williams?
There was all talk.
Fred Ward.
This was the first one, and we're going to continue this series, you know? And I remember.
The Adventure Begins is what it was called. I remember.
Yeah, so if it begins, well, isn't it going to continue? No, I'm sorry, it's not. It's never happened.
Yeah. It's too bad. I did like that movie. I guess it's probably guilty pleasure today, but
sure.
I remember enjoying it in 85.
And then, of course, another Arnold one. Remember, there was talk for so long of Arnold doing Sergeant Rock, which was kind of like a comic book World War II. And I don't remember much about it, but that was just another one on the long list of Arnold.
Well, there's another Arnold. How about Robert Rodriguez's original script for Predators?
That had Dutch in it, right?
It had Dutch.
Oh, well, I guess they couldn't swing that money, could they?
Well, I guess Arnold passed on that. I can't imagine why.
Yeah. Now, you wrote this down. Or I don't remember where I got this at the last minute. Jaws 3, People Zero. Have you heard of that?
Right. This is another classic never happened. this was an idea to take the Jaws series into the comic. Zucker, Abram Zucker style comedy.
Right.
And make a spoof of Jaws and call it Jaws 3, People Zero.
Okay.
A script was written. But I guess Spielberg didn't like the idea or whatever and voiced some concerns. And then Universal got cold feet and decided to do Jaws 3D instead. It got to the script stage. So, I mean, that's interesting. I guess everything does in Hollywood, though. I mean, what does it cost to hire a couple guys to write something, you know?
Yeah, turn it into a script. Let's see how it plays. Exactly.
Look, I'll give you each $25,000. Come back in a month with a script. So you get a script that way. 50 grand, you got a script.
Oh, man. Well, interesting. It would have been probably better than what happened with the rest of the Jaws series. It probably would have been beloved a little more. Oh, man. All right, now it's time for us to flip this thing. And even though this show is ridiculously long, we gotta hit the other categories for Never Happened. And this one's a little sibsy, if you will. It's a little personal because this has never happened in our minds. We've deleted it and cleansed it from our minds. And, of course, you've heard us talk for years about Cocoon the Return. And I love Cocoon, the first film, the Ron Howard film. Cocoon the Return was so absurd and retarded and stupid and made for no other reason than to make profit. Obviously, and they just went and usurped all what they thought were the best bits. Let's get the old folks out and energy and dancing and having good times. And that's what people want to see is you know, the old folks going out and doing crazy stuff. And so they made this abomination of a script where they came back and totally destroyed the beautiful ending from before because it was all that they were going off into space and for eternity and they were never going to come back. But no, we had to come back. And then, you know, most of them get killed off. And it just, I think two more people, two of the original actually go back into space with them to live for eternity.
No, now they want to stay.
Yeah, now they want to stay because they don't want to have to lose their grandson again. And that's understandable. But really, you know, take your grandson with you. Did you want your grandson to live forever? Let's go. It's just, yeah, what a mess. And,
no, it's a real simple. It's like, listen, we'll just come back and visit from time to time, right? Are the aliens that cruel that won't keep coming back to Earth? I mean, come on, you got a spaceship. What is fuel a cost here or something?
Well, that's the point. I guess they had to have a reason. The point is that they told them we're never coming back. Or it'll be so long, you'll be an old man by the time we come back. Or you'll be long dead when we come back. So it's just take a movie and shit all over it. And that's Cocoon the Return. It's horrible, and in my mind, it doesn't exist.
So this is kind of like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. We're going to go in and erase these memories.
Exactly.
Right?
We're going to take our list of movies, and at the top of that list is Cocoon the Return. It never happened. Now, the second one on my list is Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Oh, please, take it away.
It never happened because it's so fucking horrible. I just remember Eddie sitting there working on the computer, tap, 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 and then he makes all these dollar bills with his face on it.
I know, a gag, and not even a good one at
that. I know,
that.
But I mean, could you imagine the photoshopping and shit that would have to go on? But he's doing it with a punch of a few buttons, like they already had an image of him. When did he even pose for that picture? You know? It's just absolutely an abomination, and I dare you to watch it if you hadn't. Yes, I know that Beverly Hills Cop 2 is not a great movie, but it has its merits to it. That you could survive through it and at least get a few laughs and enjoy some Tony Scott action. But really, there's nothing redeemable about Beverly Hills Cop 3.
No, no.
Let me keep blowing on my list here. Now, you know, I almost don't want to say this, but I really must, in my mind, erase the weird creature at the end of Alien Resurrection. The pumpkin head thing. Okay? Because it's absolutely absurd. Now, whether or not I erase the whole film, I don't feel like that's necessary. But
oh, I do.
The whole thing at the end.
It's a tired plot again.
I know.
It's the cliche crew. Every single one of them is out of your handbook of cliches.
I agree.
Okay, that said, it's the same tired plot. We got to get from point A to point Z. And oh, guess what? The ship's on its way to Earth, and if we don't get it in time, we're fucked. And guess what? There's a bunch of aliens in our way.
I know.
I don't know.
Absolutely terrible. There are some things.
The first 20 minutes of that film are interesting when the aliens are in captivity.
Right.
And I think the best scene of that movie is when the aliens sacrifice one of the others so they can escape.
Right.
Now you're showing me something I haven't seen before in an alien movie. You stay in that direction, you're holding my interest. Everything else after that is a chase movie.
It becomes absurd when it becomes a chase
movie. It's as bad as Terminator 3, I think, in terms of chase.
I agree. It's absolutely terrible. But thank God, because at least, you know, it gave us more than the AVP series. And while I actually, and I have to admit it, I actually kind of like AVP, the first one, Requiem is such an abomination that to me it never happened. I just forget that absolutely did not happen. AVP Requiem is the ass of all. It doesn't even come close to Resurrection. I mean, it's really horrible. And
which one are you talking about?
AVP Requiem.
I don't know about that one.
Yeah, exactly, because it never fucking happened. Highlander 2 The Quickening.
Who?
Exactly. I keep forgetting. My time here is done, Highlander.
And so is your film.
What? What? You know what? Let me just say this. There can be only one. I forgot that there's even more Highlander films than one. Two, three, four TV series. What?
Flush. And you can add that remake that they're about to do into it also. Throw it all in the bowl and flush it.
What? Duncan MacLeod? What the fuck is Duncan MacLeod? I don't want to hear that. That's, you know, it's, forget it. You know, the whole thing.
I'll give the TV show its expanded universe. A lot of people were fans. That thing ran for 7 seasons, had spinoffs, whatever. Highlander is a great concept. I'll give
well,
it
sure.
that. So, you know, you could go so far on just the idea of just someone living for 400 years. So, you know, granted, there's probably a lot of space to explore that on TV, and you're not going to get Christopher Lambert to do it, right? Now, would you have liked it better in the TV show if they would have just called him Connor and made all of this a prequel to the events in the first Highlander film?
No. because
so there you go. They had to do their own universe, and that's
fine. But it's stupid because we would have known. You know, if they would have played by the rules, someone's going to cut his head off. He's not getting the prize.
Well, the only way it can work is the first film can't exist. It can't have been a prize. He can't have won all that.
And then when we finally got to the movie where they brought Duncan and Connor together, and then Duncan kills Connor. Whoa! It's like, you're a fucking idiot. You just killed the whole first film. There's no prize.
It's so misguided that in all the attempts to give Highlander life support, they have to never happen. The whole reason they have a franchise in the first place.
Well, the whole reason Christopher Lambert is there is because he played Connor McLeod in the first movie. But if you take away the prize, or you give it to Duncan instead of to Connor.
Yeah, I don't know what all that's
about. Oh, my God. It's like the rules are just.
So what, he can do the source?
Yeah. God, I didn't even see that. I didn't even know what that is.
It needs to stay that way.
Good. Never happened. Don't want to know. It all never happened.
There can be only one.
Yeah, that thing that they called the quickening. I mean, I know it went through its own share of production problems. But, you know, it'll always be forever known as the Zeist movie.
Well, Zeist never happened, right? To them.
I mean, now it never. To them, then they made sure. They went back and recut the movie and did a new Renegade version, shot 20 minutes of new footage, or reincorporated it back into their narrative, and got rid of Zeist, you know? Right. But, see, that's the thing is you know, that's just Monday morning quarterbacking, okay? You wanted it. You were sold on Zeist. You had script meetings where you thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
It was only when you got tomatoes thrown at you that you said, oh, okay, well, we'll change it, you know? But I don't know. I don't think there was any saving that project. And I say this as a Mulcahy fan who wanted to try to find something in it, you know. And I think it was ambitious in terms of they just didn't ape the first movie. That would have been the easier thing to do because that's what Highlander 3 does. It's the same fucking movie as the first one. They just ape it.
Ugh,
it's really bad.
Horrible.
But they tried to do something bold, jump it up into the future, into 2021 or whatever
right.
It took place in. And I mean, it was kind of hokey with all that S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff and whatnot, but it was interesting seeing him old and in that different kind of environment and how down, you know, run down the world was and how things didn't work out so great after he got the prize.
Remember this back in Starlog? What else never happened? Highlander Yellowknife.
Yellowknife.
What the fuck was that?
Man, for years I carried around that Starlog going, just scratching my head. Highlander 2, Yellowknife?
Yellowknife? What is Yellowknife going to be? Remember that was it? It was like, we're going to get a sequel finally. It's going to be called Yellowknife. What? I thought it was some sort of kind of lightsaber or something, you know?
Even a direct-to-video title wouldn't call themselves Yellowknife.
It's like, why did that ever happen?
I mean, God, that makes Zeist sound good. I'm sorry.
Man, just the whole lot of it never happened. We'll just stick with our first one, thanks. You know, Rocky V, God, how about that, man? How about Rocky fucking V?
It did happen, and then something else happened to make it never happen. It got taken away from John G. Avildsen and got Stallone-ized, and now for the better. But for the better, MC Hammer.
Well, much like Lethal Weapon 3, there's elements that you have to keep to move forward to Rocky Balboa, right? Okay, we have to know that all the money was lost, and they're back in their small-time existence, no big mansions anymore, and such. There's no money. So they're working in the real world, you know. But beyond that, really, not necessary. We don't need to see that film, and we're better off for, you know, it's logical that Rocky would want to train other fighters.
Well, it's like we said in the Rocky show, I don't have a problem with the story of Rocky V. Let's just say that I've got 4 novels on my shelf and have the Rocky V novel. I don't have a problem of it existing as a story chapter in the life of Rocky Balboa. I've got problems with the execution of the film. mostly. Right. You know, performances and dialogue, line readings, and just the tone and the music. And the film's a mess. The story's not bad, though. I thought it was a good progression for the character.
Right.
So in terms of it never happening, well, it can happen in terms of that story, but the film, I don't know. I think I'm more interested now in like the earlier work print version of Rocky V than the final attempt at making a go for it hit with putting the flag and the V and him in that pose. I mean, come on. What is that?
It's called stretching, man. That's called trying to sell when you have nothing to sell but shit. Okay, and we alluded to this earlier. Jaws 3D, Jaws the Revenge, just anything after 2. And 2's almost extraneous, too. It's just because it wasn't horrible that, you know, it's almost not necessary. But 3 and Revenge, oh, my God, just put them away.
It's really too bad, too, because it seems like Jaws is the perfect franchise to not die for Universal. You know, it's just they get so stuck in the same problems like, you know, the Aliens and the Superman movies have, or, you know, they just always feel like they got to duplicate a formula or something, or the Terminator movies. But Jaws, you could easily do a reboot of Jaws and not do Brody and Quint and Hooper. You could have it take place anywhere else but Amity. And you could just make a new Jaws movie and have different characters and situations and things and still have a couple of sharks or whatever. But just to make a new shark movie. But they won't do that, will they? They'll have to do Brody, Hooper, and Quint, right? I'm going to get a new Jaws in 3D, aren't I? They have got to be salivating over that idea at Universal
right now.
It's going
to happen in the next decade, at least in the next decade. Come on.
They can't let that property...
No.
Because that property now has become their Planet of the Apes.
Right.
It's just dead. They got to do something with Jaws.
They're going to. It's just too much money to go away from.
A 3D shark movie that's state-of-the-art is going to gross Clash of the Titans bank.
And then it's called Jaws. See, that's the deal. You can make any other shark movie. It's not called Jaws. Jaws is the official shark movie. There's only one official shark movie, and it's Jaws. It's going to happen. I guarantee you it's going to happen. We talked about Conan the Destroyer. Horrible, pitiful. I've forgotten that it ever fucking happened. Grace Jones, oh my God. It's terrible. Never happened. Superman 3 and 4, we talked about. Ridiculous. Really, just totally didn't happen.
Well, Superman Returns didn't think it happened.
Exactly, and that's one of the great saving graces of Superman Returns is it just skipped it. Yep, never happened.
Kind of like Terminator 3?
Exactly. The Sarah Connor Chronicles just said, oh, Terminator 3 never happened. Isn't that funny?
How about you? What do you say?
What do I say? Terminator 3 never happened. So did Terminator Salvation never happened.
So really, the Terminator show ends with the lines on the road, right?
No, Terminator show ends with the Sarah Connor Chronicles to me. It goes up that far for me, so there you go.
Well, at least they pick up from that shot on the TV show,
exactly, because
right?
It was class, man. It was a good show. I never saw Speed 2. Would that be one that you would just say never happened?
No. I don't know if I'd care enough, to be honest.
Did you see it?
I saw it. It's not the worst movie I've ever seen. Uh-huh. I wouldn't call it good either.
Well, it doesn't have to necessarily be terrible for you to say it never happened. If it just doesn't play into anything and it's worthless, you know?
Yeah, you know, the adventures of Annie never really seemed like they needed further chapters.
It was such a great idea. It's like, who are we going to do the adventures of, you know? Well, obviously everyone would say the cop. Oh, no, the chick who was driving the bus accidentally. Oh, yeah. She's going to get into a situation like that.
I mean, the only thing I can say is Speed 3 is probably never going to happen, right?
Oh, no. Just the reboot.
Okay.
I never saw Caddyshack 2 either.
Oh, I did.
Never happened?
Never happened.
Yeah.
Never needed to happen, never did. Yeah, that's just, you can erase that one.
Ghostbusters 2.
Who?
Yeah. Oh, God.
They might also just call this new Ghostbusters 3. Just call that one Ghostbusters 2.
We want the number back because this is gone. It's erased. Goodness. And then I put the rest of the Matrix series after the Matrix.
Think about this. Fans up in arms right now.
Now, think about this. I was the one person who actually liked Matrix Reloaded.
You did.
And a lot of people were flipped. A lot of people said they liked Revolutions and hated Reloaded, but I liked Reloaded and hated Revolutions. But if you're going to watch Reloaded, you have to have a conclusion that makes some kind of sense. So if I said Revolutions never happened, well, then Reloaded is just sitting out there without any kind of ending. So really, you almost have to say, well, the rest of it never happened. And just stick with the first one. It was fine. The rest of it never happened. Do you have any other ones in your mind that popped to mind that you just want to be gone off of you? That just they don't exist?
I think I had written down Cannonball Run 2.
Because that's important, exactly.
No.
Does that include Speed Zone 2?
there you go. Cannonball Run 2 and 3. God, if I could get rid of a couple of those for Bert, maybe his career wouldn't have been so damaged by all of those.
Yeah.
For sure. How about this one? And I've never even seen it. Patch Adams. Can I never happen that one?
That 3 or 4 run that Robin Williams did of Schmaltz. You know, it's like Patch Adams, Bicentennial Man, and Jacob the Liar. All that kind of corny shit.
Oh, man.
It was really sappy and sweet and saccharine and gross. Oh, my God. I know. Yeah. You really should see Bicentennial Man. You really should. It's one of those ones you have to sit through just because you want to take a rake and just rake all the skin off of your face after you see it. It's so horrible.
Oh, you one's family.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fun category, and I think really that's where we built the show, was starting at that point. So you good?
Yeah, I mean, putting that X-Men 3 on there was pretty good.
Ooh, yeah. Mm.
X-Men 3 and Spider-Man 3, you know, I mean,
Spider-Man
I wish
3.
Those never would have happened.
Yeah, notice these are all sequels, of course, but that's kind of the game.
If we wanted to go down the list, some of our favorite filmmakers, I'm sure we could pick out, like, you know, Francis Ford Coppola and Jack.
Yeah.
You know, can we...
Which one doesn't belong here? Fucking Jack.
I will defend The Rainmaker all the way down to the very end if it's up against Jack. Okay.
I know.
I think The Rainmaker is good. Jack... You could erase it, and you know, Coppola's record would actually look better. You could actually improve his score. It's like if you could take one film away from a filmmaker, it would just suddenly their batting average would shoot right back up, you know.
Erase the last few years of Shyamalan's career.
Like, what if you could take away Village of the Damned from Carpenter? Wouldn't his resume look a little bit better?
Yeah, oh, yeah. He's made some stinkers, but that is the stink of them all. I don't know, that or Ghost of Mars. Ghost of Mars is pretty butt-awful also.
Yeah.
So, no, that's a great game. Take a director and erase one. We'll be here for 5 hours if we start doing that shit, though.
I mean, like, James Cameron, what are you going to erase?
Avatar!
You're keeping Piranha 2.
Well, I don't even count Piranha 2, okay?
Well, you have to.
That's not fair. That doesn't count. No.
His name's on it.
No,
so.
That doesn't count.
If you took it away, just think how good his record would be.
Yeah, but you get a pass almost for your first film, right? You know?
No passes. That's not how this game works.
No, I don't count Piranha. So after that, Avatar goes.
What about Guy Ritchie?
Guy Ritchie? I've never seen that god-awful Madonna thing, so I don't want to see it. I don't want to
So it almost never happened anyway, right?
I never even allowed it to happen.
What about James L. Brooks?
Oh, my God. Everything he's done in the last 20 years? Everything after Broadcast News.
If you took away Spanglish, it would improve his record a little bit.
Oh, yeah, the one that was supposed to be a singings one with Nick Nolte, that was great, huh?
Right, yeah. I'll do anything to keep this from being a musical.
Yeah.
How about Martin Brest, the poster boy?
I think that's self-explanatory, right? I think we all know.
It's Gigli, by the way.
You take away that one film, that man has a career.
Exactly. Out of jail.
How about Joel Schumacher?
You're just like throwing softballs here, buddy.
Oh, I'm going to hit you up with some hard ones. I'm just getting you warmed up, all right?
Come on, we're going to be here forever. Oh, man. Batman and Robin, are you kidding me? Oh, I still love Mr. Freeze.
What about Michael Bay?
All of them.
Yes, okay.
Which one is mandatory? You tell me. There's about five people out there going, oh, I love The Rock. I love Armageddon. Fuck that shit. I don't want any of them.
What about Rob Reiner? Boy, you can't help his batting average much, because what are you going to do? Take away North, or rumor has it.
But anything before North is a keeper. Everything after, garbage.
You are a meathead.
What about Spielberg?
What about... Oh, come on. Another softball. I just had to think about it for a second. Come on. Oh, my God. Crystal Skull. Are you kidding me? Worst. Worst. Not even... 1941 is a classic compared to that. War of the Worlds is even good compared to that.
What about McTiernan?
McTiernan? Oh, the god-awful remake, right?
The Rollerball.
Rollerball.
That's what I'd take off his record.
He should have been put in jail.
What about Tim Burton? What film do you take off to improve his record?
Tim Burton. I was never a big fan of Big Fish.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't care much for it.
You take that over Mars Attacks or Planet of the Apes?
Well, yeah, probably. Okay. I think he's made some pretty solid films. There's a few I haven't seen. I haven't seen Corpse Bride.
What about Sam Peckinpah?
Breaker 1-9. Convoy.
You're going to take Convoy over Osterman Weekend?
You want to know why? Because Convoy is a movie made by What's-His-Ass, who made Cannonball Run, okay? It's a Hal Needham movie.
I agree, and it's not good, but I don't know. At least you got some old Sam Peckinpah alumni. You know,
yeah, Chris Christopherson and such.
You got and Ernest Borgnine and Ally McGraw, and you know.
Come on.
And there's a good fight scene in the bar that's at least got some cutting. You know,
yeah.
I don't know. I'd probably pick Osterman Weekend, but I'm with you on Convoy. It's not good, and it would be a terrible film, I guess, if that was your last film.
Yes.
You know?
But, well, see, you know what? That's really the problem with when you look at Peckinpah. He's done some that are so great, and then some that are just so like. It's like the Killer Elite should have been so fucking awesome with a title like that and all this kung fu and karate.
And the ninjas. I know,
and it was like.
I know. What about Oliver Stone?
Oh, man. Are we going to do everybody? Oliver Stone. You know what? That one that he did with Sean Penn.
Oh, U-Turn.
U-Turn. Yeah.
Taking U-Turn over The Hand.
Well, I've never seen The Hand, so I can't count The Hand.
Never seen The Hand. How do you avoid The Hand growing with cable television?
I've never seen The Hand.
God, I saw The Hand at least three or four times on cable, at least. And it's not even that I like the film. It was just on, so you'd watch it just to get to the film that was coming on afterwards.
Again, like Cameron's Piranha, it's the first movie. They're just doing anything. So what's the movie? I was going to make a movie about a hand. Fuck it, I'll direct it. You know, I need a gig. I need a chat. I got to direct something. Okay, I'll take it. I'll make it the best fucking hand movie of all time.
All right, here's a match for you. Scorsese.
Ooh. Man, all right, I'm going to get a lot of hate for this. I'm not going to say Boxcar Bertha, because that's easy. But I would say Gangs of New York.
Ah, that's funny enough. That would have been my pick, too.
Yeah, that's the one that just, you know, I was like, amazing performances, but didn't really care much for the movie.
I mean, when you got a record like Scorsese's, though, I mean, to erase that one is, you know, pretty good, I guess.
Yeah. All right, we got to move on here. I know we could play this game all day.
There's no other directors you want to play?
We can play it forever. We could just keep on going, you know?
How about Robert Rodriguez?
You get all of them, okay? No. I did enjoy a little bit of Grindhouse, but... And I like me some El Mariachi. And some Desperado. The rest can kiss my ass. All right. Next thing. All right, we came up with one. Let's erase it and remake it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Jaws 3D. All right. Well, we just talked that we forgot Jaws 3D, but today's the day when everything's in 3D that we're going to make a Jaws movie, right? I mean, why wouldn't we?
Absolutely. Remake Jaws 3D, even with the same water park.
Right,
setting.
Right.
You know, just do it better this time. Just make a better movie.
I didn't hate the idea of a water park. I mean, that's something different from the beach, you know. It's like, at least it's something different.
Exactly. I think it was a step in the right direction. I think you need a bunch of sharks, not one, obviously, and you're going to need some threats. I mean, I guess Deep Blue Sea kind of took care of that, didn't it?
Yeah, it was an interesting idea. Of course, just not handled well.
But, but definitely that'd be one worth remaking, Jaws 3D.
Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
Such a weak way to end that series.
Considering how good Conquest is, you know, number 3 and 4 are really pretty solid. They surprise you.
And obviously, they're kind of doing that, right? I mean, this is going to be... I guess this would be the movie that happened after Battle that was in current times.
Before Conquest, right.
You know, yeah, well, you're right.
Or it's a remake of Conquest, but a prequel also, sort of, I guess.
It would definitely be after Escape. So,
right.
Now, are they saying that Caesar is the child? They're not going to even say that Caesar's the child of Zira and Cornelius.
They're not saying yet. Yeah, so I don't know.
Yeah, but I bet you they won't.
They got to find a way to tie it in to that massive timeline.
I bet they won't. They'll make an ape that gets some disease or genetics, you know, something like that. And then he starts talking. But he won't have anything to do with Zira and Cornelius. We wrote down Highlander 2, but we've talked too much about Highlander 2 already. But yeah, good Christ.
You can't remake it. That's the whole point.
Nah, let's just erase it and not remake it. Let's just erase it, period. It's just, you know. All right, we put down here Transformers. Now, what were you talking about? You talking about making it more serious without all that comedy bullshit? Maybe in the hands of a different director?
Yeah, well, they're going to be making Transformers movies for fucking ever, so I guess it doesn't matter.
I think that he's the right director for the action, for all the robots and the spectacle and the bullshit. But, you know, it just his writing and his comedy insistence and all that shit just gets in the way. So, you know, and it's such a hard line. Is it for kids? Is it for adults? Do we make it a serious? Do we make it more violent? I mean, which way do you go? I think that probably everyone would have liked it to be more of an adult-oriented type of a thing. But sadly, at that point, you know, you forget the source material. This was a kid's show. This was a kid's cartoon with really stupid shit in it. So it's like you can't just get rid of that altogether. Now, another interesting one you put here was Ghost Rider. Let's erase it and remake it.
Right. Well, they're going to do a sequel. I think the Nevin and Taylor team is going to do a sequel. So we'll see what direction it takes. I mean, they can't make it worse than the first. Maybe they can.
You wrote down The Long Kiss Goodnight. What were you thinking there?
This is another one of those interesting ones of where I just think that you have these guys that write screenplays, and they always complain that they changed things or they didn't quite do the script or whatnot. The Last Boy Scout's like that. There's a whole 20-30 pages of his original screenplay that never made it into the final film. But I just think that of all the Shane Blacks, I think The Long Kiss Goodnight could work. I still think that you could recast it and make a really exciting movie out of it and potentially make a better movie than the original take on
sure.
it. And, you know, it'd be like a play, you know, just realizing Shane Black's script. So, yeah, I always thought that would be a good one, and I think a better film could be made out of it than the first go around.
Like going back and remaking that Shining version, Stephen King's official.
Oh. Yeah, that's yeah.
Whoops.
Yeah.
We want to be more true.
Hey, you know what, though? I'm so glad King finally got to do his version of The Shining, because he'd been bitching about Kubrick's film for long enough. It was time to put up or shut up. And you know what? He got it. His six-hour canvas or whatever he got for his TV, and he got to do this. The Stand was so successful, they said, you can do whatever you want. And he said, I want to do The Shining. So great. We saw how scary his version of The Shining was, so you can take your pick.
Oh, man. Now, one that I said was, this is just recently, was Land of the Lost. Now, the new Land of the Lost was butt-ass awful. It you know, had a couple of jokes if you're into the Will Ferrell zone. It's a movie that was tailored around Will Ferrell because he had some nostalgia for it and liked it. And really just became this stupid thing. Now, the thing why I say remake it is remake it serious. And I say that because if you watch the original series, it's never taken lightly. Ever. It's this real family crash lands in this prehistoric world. And, okay, so the effects look like shit today. Okay? But really, is that your reason to take it and turn it into a comedy, a camp thing? You know, remember how they did the Brady Bunch? It's like they were making fun of the time when it came out more than necessarily the show. And I think maybe that they thought that because this is an older show, you can just go in there and remake it, but remake it as this camp thing and just totally trash it. It'll never get this shot again.
Could it be anything else once you hire Will Ferrell? And not, don't you go down that road anyway?
Well, that's the problem. When you go down that road, you are making that kind of comedy. And if you treated this completely seriously, you have maybe an interesting story there. Now, you're going to have to make some really kick-ass special effects. And, I mean, sleestacks are fucking scary. When I was a kid, I remember the sleestacks were scary. And I have nightmares about sleestacks. You know, the... I mean, there was an interesting story there with the pylons and going into the pylons, and you could see through to a different time or a different location and all the things and the UFOs in the sky. There's a mythology there that could have been really pushed and very interesting. But instead of going serious, they went stupid, and now it's ruined for everybody. So that was a big fucking mistake because it was a major flop. They spent way too much money on it. You know, but that's what happens when you take something and you try to spin it in a different way. And then the other one that I put down here was Fantastic Four. And they're probably doing that now. I mean, they've stated that...
They are doing that
now. Right, they've stated they're going to go back and they're going to give us a real Fantastic Four movie instead of that stupid crap that it was. That lighthearted, jokey, you know, horribly cast thing that those two films were. I didn't hate Silver Surfer altogether, but still, you know, it was just that kind of middle-of-the-road thing. And it's a shame because it's a great property. And I think that if you treat it seriously and you get a cast in there that's worthy of it and you don't hire a scab director, you know, straight off the fucking barbershop movies to direct it, then, you know, you might have something. So that was really my choice. Now, another little section that we came up with that's kind of fun is you think about the fact that when films come to an end, when a franchise comes to an end, most of the time it had to do with the film, right? But these were always movies that they said, all right, we have plans of not just making one, but many. But you get a franchise that never happened because the first movie didn't realize it's the potential that it needed to do to make another film.
Is this the Rima Williams curse?
Well, sure, Rima Williams. You know, anytime, that's the deal now. No one ever talks about single films anymore. They get sequelophobia in the very beginning when the first movie's released, and just to make people feel better, they start talking about sequels. You know, if they know that we've got a second one coming out, maybe they'll go see this one. Hey, maybe it's for real. It's going to be a franchise. So franchise. And so these movies come out with big, long titles, like when they had Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief, okay? It was supposed to be, they've got a whole series of books. It's all about Harry Potter and scamming that Harry Potter audience. But it was set up that way. The City of Ember was a series of books, and that was just going to be the first one. And Aragon was going to be a whole series of films. The Spiderwick Chronicles, one or two books, and then you knew that was going to move into that. This Lemony Snicket, The Series of Unfortunate Events, that was a whole series of kids' books. And they were setting it up. It's like, well, this is the first one, and we'll move on. But every single time this happened, these films underperform.
Golden Compass?
Golden Compass, exactly. It's like Golden Compass is the perfect example because they were dead set on we are making a series of these. And it's interesting because it did very large numbers overseas, didn't do that big domestically in the United States, and they killed it. And really, that's a shame for people who love that series because, you know, the whole point was that you see the first one and you move into the second. And then they were all laid out
well,
to do
Narnia
that.
Almost joined this club.
Oh, absolutely. Prince Caspian came out, didn't do the outrageous numbers that Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe did. And so Disney dropped it. Nah, we're done with it. Even though that it was already well its way into pre-production and production at that point.
It probably wasn't even the film's fault that it did as badly as it did. It was marketing and when they marketed it and how they put it out.
You know? Right. Well, remember, they even came out and said and made a public announcement, we put this out at the wrong time.
Oh, totally. And I think they had the wrong marketing campaign. It was just all focused on Prince Caspian. It didn't remind me of all the elements that were returning.
Right.
Namely, the kids.
Right.
You know, you don't leave all them out. That was the carryover from the first film.
So, absolutely true. So that was one that was almost dropped. And really, I think there's so much more money that can be made there. You know, it was picked up. We've seen the first trailer on that one. So now what's going to happen with Robin Hood now that we've made that first Robin Hood film via Ridley Scott?
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath for the real Robin Hood because the whole movie is just a big setup.
Right.
I mean, where the movie ends is where the legend begins.
Right. It's the prequel. And so it would make sense. But, again, like everything else, when they say, we're going to start this new franchise, and it underperforms to a certain extent, really, then the big question comes up. Is this something that we can continue? Well, not at that budget, probably.
We need to start evoking the Salkin Clause.
Which is?
The Salkin Clause is you got to shoot two films at the same time. Like they did with Three Musketeers and Superman.
Right, you know? Right.
You got to make them both. That way you have the second one, just in case.
Right. If you're talking franchise, you got to put your neck out there. I mean, what if they would have made one Lord of the Rings and then waited to see if it would have made any money?
And it would have made money, but then they would have had to gear up again, you know, and get all that thing going.
Exactly. It would take 3 or 4 years
mm-hmm.
instead of, you know, what they did.
1 year.
I mean, that's yeah. optimal. You know, it wouldn't be like Star Wars where we waited with 3 long years. God, the longest 3 years of my life between Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. You're just like, oh, God, is it ever going to come? But yeah, absolutely. It makes complete sense. Now, here's one that you know they wanted to make into a franchise. And the first movie came out and just was demolished. People loved seeing this movie burn down in flames. And that was Speed Racer.
Oh, breaks my heart. Peter Fernandez died recently.
That's right, he did. I read that. That's a shame.
I mean, maybe Speed Racer truly is dead now.
Well, you know, it is truly considered a bomb today. I think its final gross was somewhere in $40 million. You don't spend that kind of money to get that kind of return.
Well, all I can hope is that I hope it turns into Tron. Because who would have guessed that Disney would get back behind and put so much money into a Tron sequel all these years later.
That's for sure.
I mean, Tron was not a hit. It probably did Speed Racer numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's amazing.
I mean,
what the power of nostalgia will do. And that over time it builds and builds and builds and builds. And a movie that didn't do so great is all of a sudden realized as something important, something that meant something to people.
It turned into a brand, though.
Right.
You got to remember, it's more than just a movie. They can get some games out of it. Well, they did get games.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. There's potential.
Well, it's interesting to see, but, you know, these things just got killed. Look at the interesting, very interesting story of the Hulk. It's like, okay,
right.
All right, we're going to do this big, gigantic Ang Lee version of Hulk. All right, killed the franchise. We're going to reboot fast. Fastest reboot we've probably ever seen in history. Okay? We're going to reboot. They reboot. Okay. Did about the same thing. All right, we're not going to do anymore. This franchise is killed again. And not only that, then they say, okay, we're going to do an Avengers movie with Hulk. All right, Ed Norton, you're not in it.
Yeah, I know. That's another never happened. The Avenger movie with Edward Norton in it. How about that?
Exactly. So it's like, you know, Hulk never gets a second shot. ever. You know, the only person who gets to do Hulk really multiple times is Bill Bixby. He's the only one. It's a shame because, you know, you would get these things set up and set up and set up for that great big franchise, and then that one movie would kill it, and then that franchise would go into never happen territory. So there you go. Now I've got one more category for you. What about the saloon that never happened?
Oh, I knew this was coming. This is the biggest never happened of them all. But then again, all I could say is I don't know what you're talking about.
What are you talking about? I heard somewhere about a Stanley Kubrick masterclass.
No time for the old in and out, love. I've just come to read the meter.
Never happened. And to this...
And never will.
Who the fuck said that? Who's the slimy little common shit twinkle toad cocksucker down here who just signed his own death warrant?
Oh, now there's a statement right there. I refute that statement. I think one day it's going to happen.
Everything is going extremely well.
One day we will just grow weary and say, you know what, let's just do it. And then another one that we took the big fall on was we were talking about doing outlaw cinema.
Oh, God.
You know?
Hit me with your best shot.
How many years ago we were saying, we're going to start taking your personal films and we're going to have a show where we talk to the... And you know what? It's a great concept, and I think I would love to still do that.
Hey, I saw some good films out of it. It's just too bad we never could get our shit together.
We did, and we talked to certain people about, all right, this is your show, and we're going to do this. We just couldn't get our shit together. There was technical issues. There was time. I mean, shit, when we do any shows, we're pleased as punch to get them out. So, you know what? I'm not going to put a never happened on these. I'm going to say they haven't happened yet, but I'm just going to leave my mind open for the future.
Well, see, it's tough. We're in complete control of our universe, though. You know, if we control our studio, we can make whatever film
right,
we want, you know?
Exactly.
We can make it happen, so...
Well, hey, as far as Kubrick goes, they got a discussion today about a film that never happened. So there you go. You know, two films that never happened from Kubrick. So
yeah.
They got that Kubrick. We get Kubrick here bouncing around a little bit here and there, but who knows? We may surprise you one day. But anyways, there it is. Our look at the world that never happened. The things that never really happened, the things that we've decided to never allow in our head to accept that they ever happened.
It's a wonder that this show ever happened.
Maybe it still won't. Something will happen. It's a true wonder that this show even really happened, because we were joking about that this show never happened, because this is our second time to record it, because we had a system crash on the first time we recorded this. So that's became a joke that this never happened as well. But if you're listening to it now, it did happen finally. And so there we go. We're just happy to get something that did happen actually out, even if we're really talking about movies that never existed.
Not a complete slam show, but, you know, has its moments.
Can't help it, you know. We can't turn turds into gold. And sometimes we got to talk about turds.
So where do you go after it doesn't happen?
I guess you simply just go back to a place where anything's possible, and hopefully the best and the good will prevail, and we'll get good things, good movies that do exist, that mean something somewhere to somebody, and that they actually happened.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.